I think what's most likely. There we go.
We're on. Well, welcome everybody to the November Legislative Days meeting of the Business and Transportation Committee. We've got a good discussion today on one of the issues is dealing with the economy of the state, particularly on transportation, and a list of people here that are going to testify. I think it should be very interesting. So, Patrick, you want to get us started?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe for the Oregon Trade and Logistics Initiative, we're going to be led off by Vince Porter from Business Oregon.
Welcome, Vince.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Vince Porter. I am the governor's policy advisor in jobs and economy, and I'm also currently serving as interim director at Business Oregon. I just want to provide a few short remarks and just sort of maybe a little bit of framework of how we got to here with this work. And Governor Brown has been committed to the issues surrounding our export and importers dating back literally to the first day that she took office when she, I think one of her first calls as governor was to Secretary of Labor Perez when we were all dealing with the entire West Coast port slowdown and looking for solutions there. So she's been engaged literally from day one. And one of the in light of the challenges that we've had at Terminal 6 and some of the frustrations that she's wanted us to explore what other things can we do in addition to seeing a resolution at Terminal 6. And that's really where the idea of starting with this trade and logistics work, and when she used $250,000 of the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund to fund this work. I want to just briefly just talk about Terminal 6 and where we are. We're absolutely still committed to seeing that be resolved. We, though, strongly feel that it needs to be resolved with our both management and labor entities there at the terminal. We are willing and able to work with both of them so that they can get a little closer and get all of the terminal back up and running. But in light of that, we want to continue to look at what opportunities we have around the state. And one of the things that of this work that struck the most to me was some context that I think is really important. And I think we heard from the Department of Agriculture along the way that 80% of our containerized agricultural exports does not run through Terminal 6. And yet we hear from our agricultural industry of the challenges that they face of getting their goods out and to market. So I think that identifies that we have challenges beyond Terminal 6. We need to explore ideas of how we can move goods quicker and more efficiently. And I hope that the people that worked on this plan will be presenting in front of you some ideas and thoughts that we all can work together and move forward on as steps that we have the power to take in the near and distant future. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'd let the people that did the work come up and speak.
Vince, I would just add that one of my concerns, this is the Transportation Committee, and one of my concerns is even if we resolve things at Terminal 6, if you look ahead with the forecast of the congestion in the Portland metro area, we still are going to have a problem even getting to Terminal 6, let alone Puget Sound or someplace else. So some of this discussion is short-term, long-term looking at that, because that's a huge problem.
And Chair Beyer, I think that's a great point, and I think, excuse me, it allows us to look at all modes of transportation. I certainly would applaud the effort that the Port of Portland is working on relating to barge service up and down the Columbia River. I know that they continue to work on that and getting that up and running, which would obviously free up some more of our roadways up and down I-84.
Fred? Excuse me, Senator Rudd.
The question I would have is, from a rural legislator's point of view, the world doesn't revolve around Portland. We have two potential areas. We have Portland. We also have the port of Coos Bay, which we'd like to develop. As the governor really kind of decided that we should move forward with a lot of improvements down in Coos Bay. Most of us would really like to see Coos Bay developed and be an alternative to Portland, so that when term six or whatever you want to call it goes down, that we have another port to ship out of.
Vice Chair Gerard, I think it's a great point, and I think part of the work that was done, whether it's, I think the Port of Newport has been interested in expanding their capacity, Port of Coos Bay certainly with the projects that they have going on. I think part of this work was identifying what it would take to get some of these ports to that level to either be an alternative to Port of Portland or others, or what would its individual niche be, and hopefully some of those questions were worked on in this, and you could ask people like Peter Friedman and others about what
I think you'll hear about that.
What that capacity would be.
Well, let me make one other point. Portland, the bad thing about Portland is it's inland so far. The Port of Coos Bay is right there, and so just personally, I'm a big proponent of developing Coos Bay.
I appreciate the comments, and I think we would absolutely look at whatever opportunities there are if there's the adequate resources to support it. It's something we should really look at, alternatives.
Okay. Any other questions? Vince, before we go on? Thank you very much. And Peter, whoever you want to bring up with you. I'm not quite sure how you got this panelized. I just got a long list here, so I'm going to let you do that.
It's me, and I got show and tell.
Good.
So, first of all, thank you very much. I'm Peter Friedman. I've been contracted with the Business Oregon for the Trade and Logistics Initiative. And I want to start out by thanking two members up here, two senators, for coming to the workshops. Pendleton in Ontario, Senator Johnson, Senator Beyer, you spent all day up there in Wilsonville listening to the problems, challenges, and solutions. And I think that speaks very well, because these are serious issues, and I'll get to that PowerPoint in a moment. So we've put together a panel, and thanks for the invitation to assemble this panel, so we can talk a little bit about the solutions, but also first tee up some of the challenges. Very good point. A lot of these challenges, as you look there, those are rural challenges, a lot of them, not all. And so we're going to address that. And so this panel has four people. Actually, you see two of them, two more coming. It's not a vision test.
That would be fine.
So we have Shelley, who is going to speak about the fundamental cargo that we export out of Oregon. It's agriculture and forest products. That's the largest cargo, by the way, that moves out of Seattle, Tacoma, Portland, and other ports as well. So Shelley will talk about the exports. On the import side, Patty is a customs broker, freight forwarder, and we'll talk about the impact on imports, on the cost of living in the urban areas and the rural areas. And then we're going to talk a little bit about some of the solutions. The solutions, very frankly, two words, rail and truck, because you've got to get up to a seaport. Maybe you can go to Oakland, but in fact, it's Seattle and Tacoma you need to go to. So by rail, and we'll have Gary Cardwell, Randy Carpenter, will talk about the trucking options. And those are the solutions, or at least the workarounds, particularly with T6 in hiatus. And why should you care? Well, that was a question we were asked by the Oregon Congressional delegation, both on the House and Senate side in Washington, earlier this year with a West Coast port meltdown, and nobody was doing anything about it. So in a matter of, Shelley, how many days? About 4 days, we had 359 Oregon companies put their name on a letter. We have the list here. It's 10 pages of Oregon companies, from the family Filbert grower to Les Schwab and everybody in between, the counties, cities, and to the Oregon delegation that, frankly, but for Greg Walden and Kurt Schrader, were reluctant to be involved in this labor management dispute. They got this letter, and within 48 hours, they did communicate to President Obama forcefully that he needed to get engaged and get involved on this. So they did. And we still have these. If we would have had another 4 days, they would have double the number. Because this, when cargo can't get in and out, it impacts everybody. That's what we had. Now, let me be clear what we're talking about here. We're talking about containerized cargo. That's these steel boxes, 8 foot high, 8 foot wide, 20 foot or 40 foot long. Some refrigerated, most not refrigerated. We call them dry. All right? That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about the big bulk ships carrying soybeans and grain that feed the big grain elevators up and down the Columbia River. We're not talking about those. Those were not impacted, and they're still moving quite nicely. We're not talking about the automobile ships. Those are operating just fine. Those are dedicated ships. We're talking about the container ships, which carry essentially everything that we're wearing, every pen, every electronic, every TV, everything, and all of the hay and almonds, filberts, everything that goes out of the state, forest products and so forth.
Pears.
Pears.
Absolutely, pears. You bet.
Especially pears.
Refrigerated. Here's what happens if the cargo can't move. There were more Washington State apples this year that were spread on the potato fields in eastern Washington to rot and used as fertilizer than were sold to Asia. Those were all destined to go to Asia. They couldn't get out. So this has been a huge problem for the West Coast. So the bottom line is, for Oregon exports, like most U.S. exports, there's nothing that's produced here that cannot be sourced somewhere else in the world. The cows in Japan don't care if the hay or the timothy is coming from Shelley's farm or an Argentinian farm. And they will move. Potatoes coming from Klamath Falls may not come from Klamath Falls this year because the dollar's high. They were an undependable supplier last year because the West Coast ports. And listen, you can get great potatoes out of Poland and Holland. So, you know, there's nothing that we have market on. Christmas trees, we can talk a little bit about Christmas trees, aren't going out of Oregon in the numbers that went before. They're going out of British Columbia, Soviet Union, and so forth. Everything can be replaced. And once it's replaced, it's very hard to get it back. So we got to be able to deliver affordably. So Business Oregon went forward with a program, and we put together workshops around the state. The objective is to keep Oregon's products moving in and out. So I'm just going to recap very briefly the workshops. The first one was Portland, and you see furniture there, Dungeness crab, wine, other beverages, but all the things that you expect going in and out of Portland. And we heard from 125 folks who came to the meeting, and none of them get paid to come to meetings. They came to this and talked about their challenges. And some of the problems are very significant, and it is changing business patterns. If you can't get your furniture into a plant here in Portland where you do the finishing work, you have the finishing work done over in Asia and direct ship to your customers somewhere else in the United States, and let the 15 guys that are working in that upholstery plant that you had in Portland, let them go. That's what happens bit by bit. Then we went to Redmond. Not a huge volume of imports and exports, but a lot of interesting stuff. And there's a off-road vehicle that is manufactured up there. And that's coming out of a container. It gets shipped into one of those ocean containers. But again, increased costs make life pretty difficult for somebody there who's got to compete with other people around the world. And then we went to Hermiston, and that was seeds. And you see huge volumes of seeds. Talk about a rural economy that's dependent upon what they can grow. If they can't get it out, that's a real problem for that community. And then we went on Ontario, onions. And there you have competition, because there are folks in Idaho right across the way. They have higher truck weight limits that they can use. They've got different regulations and so forth. So the Oregon Onion guys are up against it now, and now you add the difficulty of being able to access a port to get out. I'm going to leave that to Shelley, but that was in Albany. We had 62 people came to Albany and talked about what's Oregon's largest export commodity and the challenges of getting it out. And, you know, you got to feel bad for these folks, because I think Shelley might mention it. She's competing with hay growers in Ellensburg. That's 2 hours from Seattle and Tacoma, which has 19 carriers and 45 destinations, or the Imperial Valley of California, 2-3 hours from Port of L.A. Long Beach, where the freight cost over to Asia from there is almost nothing, so they get advantage there. So there's real challenges for Oregon just because of where Oregon is located and distance. And then potatoes, that was in Medford. We heard from folks in Klamath Falls who, as I mentioned, high price of the dollar. Japanese buyers are saying, we're not going to buy. You were undependable last year. And how are you going to truck from Klamath Falls to Seattle and Tacoma? The hours of service limit only lets the trucker be in there for about 11 hours. And when you get to Tacoma, you're spending maybe 2 hours waiting to get in the gate and an hour and a half to get through the gate and back out. So now you're hiring two trucks, two drivers, and a hotel bill. In fact, we had one person, Lexi Crawford, who's been very active. She was going to come up here and testify. It's a 5.5-hour drive just to here, right? She didn't get paid to come to meetings, and she's got to run the operation down there, so she couldn't make it. So you can imagine the trucking challenges. So what we're finding, that everybody can get it on a truck, even though there's a truck shortage. We'll hear, and there's a driver shortage, and the costs of trucking are going up exponentially all over the country because of reduced hours of service driving time, because of more monitoring, emission standards, and so forth. But you can get it on a truck. But that truck cost to get it all the way to a seaport is getting unsustainable. So the alternative is rail. And if you can get it to rail, and Oregon has is good fortune, there is some rail access. Northwest Container, Gary will talk about it, that gets you from either Boardman or Portland on the rail. Now, if there's ocean service that comes back into the river, that's fantastic, and that's the most important for a number of reasons. One is because it provides capacity, but the other one is it provides competition for the ocean carrier that calls in Seattle and Tacoma, who's right now thinking, I can make those Oregonians pay for that dray down to Portland or from Portland up. Right now, they so-called equalize it, you know, because they've had competition with a carrier that comes in. The carrier doesn't come in here anymore. Then they're just saying, that's on your dime. So, Shelley, another $400 to get your cargo up there, another cost. So those, I want to convey here, there's a national challenge with truck, with rail, and with the price of the dollar, and a lot of challenges. But they're exacerbated here in Oregon, and the T6 exacerbates it further. These are challenges that you're going to have to address, I think, on this committee to keep Oregon's fundamental economy going. So those are challenges. I'd love to answer questions, but I'd rather give you the opportunity to hear from people who actually know what they're talking about here. And we're going to start with Shelley.
Okay. Great. Chair Beyer and committee, thanks for the opportunity to speak about something that's so near and dear to my heart. My name is Shelley Bossart Davis, and I help run our family farm and business with my parents. And we represent Bossart Trucking, Bosco Trading, Cresco, and SJB Farms in Tangent, Albany, and Salem. We're a farm, we're a trucking company, we're a manufacturing facility, and also an export company as well. We started in 83, my parents started in 83, with two trucks and eventually expanded to 36 trucks out on the road today, and we became an international agricultural exporter. Today, with nearly 50 employees, and of course those 50 employees and their families, our farm and agribusinesses work together providing food, grass seed, and forage to customers locally and all over the world. We farm about 1,100 acres, and we bale over 22,000 acres of grass straw throughout the Willamette Valley, from Woodburn to Junction City, from Lebanon over to Corvallis. We bale for and help support 68 farm families, and of course, those farmers help support many, many employees and their families. The straw that I handed out to you, that actually goes over to mainly Japan and Korea, and that feeds beef and dairy farms in those countries. This picture that I have up here is just to show, this is one of our trucks, and you see on the back a PR campaign, almost everything starts on a farm and ranch. And you being in the legislature, you've seen in articles, you've heard testimony about that urban-rural divide, and I think we all know that that exists. I know it does every time I ask a sixth grader that comes and tours our farm through the Adopt a Farmer program, and I say, where's your milk come from? And they say, Safeway. And, you know, we've got a lot of work, and I think that we're all invested into our youth and making sure that we can bridge that. Gary Roth with ODA here will tell you how important Oregon agriculture is to all of us. For us in Oregon's countryside, it's our lifeline. We're faced with many competitive hardships in the global marketplace. The dollar's strong. We were selling to Japan just a few years ago at about 88 yen, Japanese yen, to the U.S. dollar. This morning I checked and it's 123. That is a huge competitive disadvantage when you're talking about other countries. Our customers can purchase that kind of grass straw or a similar type of forage from Australia. They can purchase it from China. They can grow their own in small amounts. And they can purchase it even from Spain. Spain is actually exporting a very nice alfalfa. So these increased regulations that we see through small business and trucking companies increase our costs, and we just can't pass that on to the customer. And even if we could, other countries aren't increasing their costs, and so it's a competitive disadvantage. Let's see. There we go. So this is one of our trucks. I think we're actually waiting in line during the port crisis, and one of our drivers got this, and obviously we're very proud of our trucks, as you can see by us snazzing it up a little bit. We also made this during National Truck Driver Appreciation Week a couple months ago. With these increased costs of doing business, losing the container port at Terminal 6 has been devastating. Back in 2012, the electrical union and the warehouse or labor union there had some issues. That was in 2012. Prior to 2012, we probably had about 90% of our export business go through Terminal 6 and Northwest Container Service. Since 2012, we are about 40% Portland, and the rest were going up to Tacoma and Seattle. With this decision came many problems. One happens to do with our truck drivers. They can only make one turn if they're going up to Tacoma and Seattle. If we were at Terminal 6, we can make three or four turns. We don't have to have extra trucks or extra drivers. And most importantly, we're in a historical time as far as turnover for truck drivers, very hard to find truck drivers. And sometimes those drivers don't make it back down from Seattle and Tacoma. When that happens, they either have to pull over and wait, which puts them out of service, which puts our equipment out of service, our trucks out of service, and most importantly, they don't get home to their families. We all want to be home to our families. If you're running late here in the legislature, that's the worst thing, right? You have to be here till 7, 8 o'clock, and you can't get home to your families. So, again, turnover, it makes it very tough on us in order to do that. So them staying overnight somewhere is our last resort. I did want to point out when Peter said people can find things everywhere in the world. That's true. I have a colleague in Hong Kong, and he went to the local grocery store always. He was born and raised an Oregonian, and he always buys Tillamook cheese. Always.
Yes.
Right? Love Tillamook cheese. He can't find it anymore because they've replaced that with a French cheddar. And I think we'd all agree, Senator Johnson, that's horrible. And whether that's due to exchange rate, due to the port crisis in general, or due to us losing our container service here in Portland, it's a big deal. They can find it somewhere else. Whether it's our grass straw, whether it's Tillamook cheese, we're replaceable. We're absolutely replaceable. And some of these competitive advantages are just not in our favor at this point. I did want to point out, this is, real quick, this is the straw going through our baler beforehand. That's a 17-year-old kid operating that tractor. He's been on our farm for, this is his third year. He's making $13 an hour. We hire about 30 to 35 kids, whether 14 to 24, throughout the summer, and he's doing a pretty darn good job. Not bad for a 17-year-old. And then I was in Japan just last week. On the left is our warehouse in Salem. You can see we're stacking some of those packages pages of grass straw after they've been compressed, and we're about to put them into the container. On the right is our warehouse of our customers in Japan, in the South Island in Kyushu. It's called Fukuoka, Japan. And it's pretty amazing to me. I've been doing this. I was in a tractor at 11, and we started exporting in 2001. And I'm pretty proud to be part of the greater team that's providing food, forage for the world. And any advantage that we can get in order to do that is certainly helpful. I do want to say thank you for listening, and I'd also like to volunteer myself, and anybody else on this panel, I'm sure, will say, you know, we're on the front lines of this, and we see this, and anytime you have any questions, I'm definitely available for that, and I appreciate your time today.
Shelley, could you just explain a little bit about the recent change in the trucking rules and the time limits and the problems with getting stuck outside or inside the gate?
So it's due to the Federal Motor Carriers, FMCSA, not to be confused with the FSMA that's coming down too. FMCSA, it's the Federal Motor Carriers, and they have a limitation on hours of service, and that's just come through the pipeline in the last couple of years. And so once they, and some other trucking companies can say this better, but they hit 11 hours, and there's certain rules that you can hit 13 maybe once or twice, and you have to recertify. But if they hit that 11 hours, they can't drive anymore. I mean, for them to do so, say they get in a wreck, we obviously say those are the rules, pull over. Sometimes we can go up and pick up that person. Sometimes it's Portland, but then we either have to switch drivers and have somebody else drive the truck back, which, as you can imagine, is a logistical nightmare, or they just have to simply pull over, recertify so many hours before they can be on the road again. And it's very frustrating, especially since they're not that many hours on the road. When they're sitting at the port, it goes against their hours. They're literally sitting, they're waiting, they're not driving, and it still goes against their hours. And we've really fought that to say, hey, you know, if they're sitting at the port, just last week at one of the terminals in Tacoma, one of my drivers waited 3.5 hours outside the gate, and then once he got inside the gate, he waited for another 2 hours. That driver didn't make it back home. He had to pull over and recertify. So those are some of the issues that we're up against, is that it's called the hours of service.
The one that impressed me is that depending on where they were, they may not be able to get into the queue to even get in if they're going to get stuck.
Correct.
Run out of hours, because when they run out of hours, if they're online or not, they can't do anymore.
Correct. And we're coming from Salem, is where our press is, and anything farther than us, it makes it that much harder. There's a hay export company out of Eastern Oregon called Dinsdale Hay, and for them to get to the port and back is practically impossible, and they really have to almost have 1.5 people per route, and so it's making it very, very tough.
Questions?
I just want to thank you for your testimony. Many of the things you said today, you could come and give that same testimony at the hearings we had last year when they passed paid sick leave that impacts agriculture, the minimum wage issue we're going to be facing in this next session. All those things you said about those things greatly impact ag. We have nothing. We're in a world economy, we're in world competition, and all these extra regulations, whether it's to trucking or paid sick leave or minimum wage, affects agriculture, and we have no control over those things. So thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
I would just add on trucking, and I know you agree, what's coming down the pike is a possibility of greater emissions standards, more stringent emission standards. I'm not going to say great, but more stringent, similar to what's in California, which is actually driving businesses out of business in California already, this new CARB truck emissions regulations. And I just urge you all to consider the impact of another step. No other state's done this, but California has, and I'd urge you caution before going there, because it will exacerbate the issue here for you.
It was a bill last year.
Yeah.
That's
right. Geez,
I don't know who supported it and who was opposed. But.
I'm trying to caution you not to do it, because we have some of the competitors down there who are going to be facing huge costs. Patty?
Yep. Peter told me I had 6 minutes. I can hardly say my name in 6 minutes. So, okay. I'm Patty Iverson Summer with Global Trading Resources. I'm the founder and current president of a customs house brokerage. No, we do not build fancy houses. Freight forwarding company and third-party logistics company. We are the head of the octopus that has our tentacles in every domain of international transportation, movement of goods from and to the U.S. to overseas and back again. So I just listed a few of the parties involved in the transaction. You have your manufacturer, your supplier, and also your buyer, the two people at both ends. I get involved, my company gets involved from the point the sale is made or prior, doing quotes, selecting carriers, selecting terminal operators who are going to handle that cargo so that I can put together a legitimate bid. Now, I venture to say, if you would look at the labels in any of your clothing, it would probably come from someplace other than the U.S. We would like them to be more in the U.S., but the reality is that it's not. Most of the clothing is coming from China. Moreover, it will start coming from Vietnam and Cambodia. We are going to start seeing more things coming out of Africa. We see a lot of fine foods coming out of Europe and wild boar from Patagonia. This is a worldwide market, and it is not going to change. So I wanted you to be aware of all the parties that it takes to make goods move from one country to another country. So you have your buyer, seller, you have your foreign banks, your Ex-Im banks, you have your ocean carriers, your consolidators, your NVOCCs. I am an NVOCC. You have your air carriers, your indirect air carriers. I am also an indirect air carrier. I don't own my airplanes, but I do set up shipments. Mm-hmm. We have your truck and rail modes of transportation. I deal mainly in intermodal, where cargo moves from one mode of transportation to another mode. You also have your traditional freight forwarder. I am a freight forwarder. I'm licensed by the Federal Maritime Commission. And then you have your terminal operators like ICTSI in Oregon. There's many different terminal operators in some ports, like in Antwerp. There are maybe 5 or 6 different companies that operate terminals. There are all of the people that are employed by the government agencies. My nearest and dearest friends, Customs and Border Protection. I also work with Food and Drug. I work with U.S. Department of Agriculture and sometimes two divisions of U.S. Department of Agriculture, the marketing division as well. We have the Bureau of Industry and Security, the Federal Maritime Commission, and the list goes on. We have 40 different federal agencies that we need to deal with. And sometimes one transaction can have 4 different agencies. Me being the head of the octopus, I have my hands with all of them. I am fortunate to, do you want to change that? I am fortunate to belong to a worldwide network of brokers and forwarders that enables small and mid-sized companies to do what the big guys, the FedEx, the Expeditors, the DHLs do a door-to-door service. And as such, I can meet with all of my overseas partners, and they come from Africa, all over Europe, all over Asia, all over South and Central America. I have the opportunity to discuss one-on-one with them how to route their freight into the U.S. Up until this last May at our last meeting, I have taken Port of Portland literature and sold it. Any cargo I can route through the Port of Portland is an advantage to me. It is an advantage to the customers that I serve, and it's also an advantage to all of the people that provide services for the movement of that cargo. That means jobs, folks. I'm a small forwarder. I support 9 families. The lowest wage is $15 an hour. I pay full health care benefits for all my employees and their families if they need it. I'm just a small guy, or lady. But we handle Most of my customer base are small and mid-sized companies. They employ people as small as five employees up to 150. But to discuss more to the point, the impact of the closure of the container service at Terminal 6, I'll give you an example. One of my longtime customers brings in raw materials from Japan into Tualatin to manufacture products that are then sold domestically and also re-exported. They employ 150 people. Prior to the closure, we would bring those containers in via Hanjin. A lot of refrigerated cargo because it's temperature sensitive, high value cargo. Bring it in to Terminal 6. It was a nice quick turnaround. Customs and Border Protection knows this company. All other agencies know this company. We put it on a truck down to Tualatin, $275 to $300. That changed after Hanjin pulled out. Now they're containers. At first, because of all the congestion, we could only ship as far as Seattle. Now it's loosened up. They can bring down the dries on the rail. But the reefers are still discharging in Seattle and Tacoma. The trucking charge goes anywhere from $900 to $1,200 per container, and they bring in four and five containers at a time. You can see how that's going to augment. Plus, you add in bringing those into a port where they are not so well known. You add in the possible exam where we have to move a container to an exam site. That's another $500. The exam for DVAN could be another $1,000. Pretty soon, you're paying an additional $3,000 a container. Multiply that by five. That adds up a lot. You're not only talking additional costs, but you're talking additional delays. Delays to 2 and 3 weeks sometimes for an exam or even just getting it out of the terminal. Those costs are going to be passed on, and those costs are going to be passed on to the Oregon consumer. End of story. We need that container terminal operating. We need workarounds, we need depots, we need alternatives, and Senator Drodge, you were talking about congestion on the road for truckers. We put outbound containers on the barge instead of on trucks. That's going to help. We put containers on the rail instead of on trucks. Now, I don't belittle the truckers. We're having hard enough time, and they do their service, but I'm looking at alternatives to some of the hardships we're seeing in the trucking industry. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Okay. Who's next? Thank you. We're going to proceed now to the solutions. You've heard about the trucking, and you've heard about the rail option, and here we're going to have Randy Carpenter of Pathfinder and Gary Cardwell of Northwest Container Services, which is the rail option.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
My name is Gary Cardwell. I'm the Divisional Vice President of Northwest Container Services. We've been in business for 30 years, moving international freight from Oregon to Portland, Tacoma, and Seattle. Next slide. How do I do that?
We push something here.
Okay. We subcontract with the Union Pacific Railroad to hook and haul our rail cars from our facilities to our facilities. We move from Portland to Seattle, Tacoma. And we're also running a service from that service has been running for over 30 years, and we run a service from Portland to Boardman. That we built that facility in 2009 with the help of Connect Oregon funds, and we've been moving a combination of exports as well as Schnitzer auto fluff, the stuff that's left over after the cars are shredded. Next. We run five to six trains a week to Portland and Seattle, and we run five to six trains to Portland and Tacoma. The trains are approximately 8,000 feet long, anywhere from 250 to 300 containers a train. The train departs Portland drops a block off in Tacoma and then continues up to our site in Seattle, and then those cars in Tacoma are pushed on dock there in Seattle. We truck it from our facility to the Port of Seattle, and yes, our trucks too are waiting anywhere from, we're a mile away, and our trucks are waiting anywhere from 2 to 3 hours to get onto the terminal.
Next. You can see it.
Oh. We work with 17 different steamship lines. Our customers are the steamship lines. APL, Costco, Hamburg Sud, on down. Next. Their customers are the importers. Columbia Sportswear, Costco, Dollar Tree, Xerox, Doc Martin, Lowe's, Target, Nike, Les Schwab. We probably move anywhere from 100 to 150 containers a week of just tires from Les Schwab. Exports. Again, we move heavy exports. Exports in Oregon, the can and cargo weight is about 60,000 pounds, so it needs the super axle, the eight axle trucks, straw, lumber, apples, building materials, malt. We do a lot of what's called milk carton stock, juice box stock with Weyerhaeuser, but we move on a 3-to-2 northbound to southbound ratio, so we move more. There are more exports in Oregon than there are imports in Oregon. Average over the last 15 years, we've averaged about 60,000 containers a year, and this year with Hanjin leaving, Halfback Lloyd, we're on track to do about 95,000 containers this year. So our volume increased about 40,000 containers this year. We own our own container lifts and our own rail cars. The rail cars were all bought by from Gunderson here in Portland. We do have two Connect Oregon applications that will be coming out. We're looking for a few more container lifts, and we're looking to cut down the 23 49-foot five-well cars. You can see they have a well capacity of 115,000 pounds when we bought them in 1997. And in order to double-stack two heavy Oregon exports now, you need the 125,000-pound wells. So we're working with Greenbrier that has a facility in Springfield that's literally going to cut 9 feet out of the middle of the well, weld it back together. It'll be a 40-foot well, and it'll have a well capacity of 125,000 pounds. We've got 90 acres in Portland. We've got a capacity of about 8,000 containers, and we hit 7,600 this year. I thought people were going to collapse at that point. Again, we move about 250 to 300 containers a day. Our hours in Portland are 5:30 to 3:30, so we tend to cater more towards the exporter. So if you're coming up from the valley, you want to get there early. And I probably have 50, 60 trucks at 5:30 in the morning waiting outside our gate in order to get 3 to 4 turns a day, because the last thing they want to be doing is driving I-5 at 1 o'clock north of Portland. We fired 42 people this year. We had five retirements and two employees transferred, but we fired 35 new people. That took us 6 months to do. I had people working anywhere from 16 to 18 hours a day at the facility to try to keep up with all this until we got people hired. We've invested $5 million in infrastructure and equipment this year. We bought 6 new container lifts, asphalting, railroad ties, offices, graders, information technology, which is the big thing that the steamship lines use. But, yeah, $5 million worth of new capital this year and 35 new employees. That's my story.
And I would offer this. This is a model of an inland port. They exist around the country, and they're more being considered and developed as congestion exists in Savannah, in Los Angeles, Long Beach, in Oakland. People are looking for alternatives as places where you can load your cargo from these rural areas where it's coming from without driving right into Oakland and L.A., Long Beach, and so forth. So this is a model that exists around the country, and I think with the loss of the service at T6, we're fortunate that it was already in place here to supplement the trucking. And here is the trucker.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I'm Randy Carpenter with Pathfinder. I'm the Vice President of Operations for our asset-based division. Our business is an Oregon-based business that supports over 50 families by employment and over 150 customers in business. Today's message is pretty simple from the trucking standpoint, and I think the issues are pretty clear. I've got some slides I'm going to present on a bullet. I'm going to go through it on a bullet point basis, so I won't. My wording's not going to match exactly what's there, but my points will be covered. The critical point is that trucking is critical to the supply of goods. The cargoes that we have delivered to our hospitals, our schools, our businesses, and our homes all are delivered via trucks. The planes, the trains, and the vessels do not back up to any of our homes. Our trucking industry continues to be faced with many challenges. With the decisions and actions that you folks take, those will impact the growth opportunities for us in Oregon. Some of those issues that I'm going to talk about today, the three that I have on my list, is growing driver shortage, which has already been discussed, equipment challenges, and governance. Governance, the regulations that us in the trucking business are held to. Driver shortage is real. It's very real. By the end of this year, in the next 6 weeks, it is expected that there will be a shortage of nearly 48,000 driving positions. By the end of 2024, that'll grow to nearly 175,000 positions. That's job opportunity. That's growth opportunity for our economy. Those numbers are not just numbers I made up. Those numbers are taken from the 2015 driver shortage analysis by the ATA, the American Trucking Association. Very happy to supply that in full report upon any request afterwards. Equipment challenges. The equipment challenges. Thank you. Next slide.
Senator?
Thank you. If you would excuse a question from the cheap seats.
Please do.
I am aware of the fact that Nebraska has made a very aggressive move to train and recruit truck drivers. I believe that they have a program, if you're familiar with it, that matches private industry and government dollar to dollar. How deleterious to Oregon is it that Nebraska would undertake this aggressive training and retraining of truck drivers, given the paucity of available drivers in this state?
I believe it's very wise on Nebraska's part. I am not familiar enough with what you're speaking of, but that is one of the main issues that I'm speaking to today. It's the top of my list is driver shortage. How do we work together to fix this? Drivers result in capacity that we need very much. And unless we find a solution to promote that capacity, it'll continue to shrink. I've got a few other things I'd like to talk about with regard to driver shortage, if I can. Actually, in my last point here, I'll go over some solutions that might hit a little more on that point, if that's okay.
Thank you.
Okay. With regard to equipment challenges, weight challenges are quite an issue. As Gary had mentioned, export cargo loads, we're, as a state of Oregon, one of the top providers of agriculture products and food products to the world. Those products are dense products and are heavy. Those typical loads, just the cargo payloads, are between 50 and 65,000 pounds. I'm going to try to simplify this for you. The standard truck and trailer you see going down the road has five axles. That holds 80,000 pounds. That's what we're limited to. That means the most cargo we can put on standard equipment is 40 to 44,000 pounds in general terms. So how do we get more capacity on those same trucks? We need to address what those weight restrictions are, limiting the amount of cargo that we can export and be productive and efficient with our moves. Equipment distance. The current Port of Portland T6 issues have added another 250 to 300 plus miles to every trip. Some of this is a little repetitive to previous testimonies, but very important to understand. Increased equipment costs, costs that were not there 5 years ago. We now have to pay for the rental cost of trailers that hold the containers where 5 years ago that was zero. Today, it's over $30 a day for that trailer use and continues to climb on an almost quarterly basis. Next slide. Governance. age restrictions mandate by the state of Oregon that individuals must be 21 to apply for a Class A CDL license. Why can't we offer the opportunities for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds to have that? Go through the same process that a 21-year-old has to do today. I'll talk more about that in solutions as well. Weight restrictions, but that is a government, that is a regulated issue. Weight restrictions, as I just mentioned, 5 axles, 80,000 pounds. That's a government regulated mandate. How do we work to increase that so that we can move more products on the same loads? Thirdly, hours of service, as it was mentioned earlier. The FMCSA is federally regulated, but your help would be great. Today, we currently have 11 hours of service driving time. That's any time the driver's on the clock. Doesn't matter if he's sitting in the line. That's counted as driving time. So 11 hours of a 14-hour shift is the max. They have to stop right where they're at. Or not only the driver faces heavy penalties and fines, but so does the business. They share that. Goes against our safety ratings. Understand, I'm not opposed to 11-hour shifts driving. I'm not looking to increase that necessarily. But there is talk about decreasing those hours of service, and we have to stay away from that because that's going to restrict and reduce capacity, which in turn reduces productivity. That turns to reduced growth opportunity.
Mr. Chair. One other thing that is not absolutely germane to this conversation, but I just want to point it out to the audience and to the panel, is that during this last forest fire season, driver limitations prevented some of the major firefighting airports from getting aviation fuel timely. LeGrand was pumping between 15 and 20,000 gallons a day. Redmond was nearly out of fuel, and so it isn't just the impact on the import-export market. It greatly affects, these new regulations greatly affect our ability to fight conflagration.
Very good point. Thank you, Senator. And I would add, the points that I brought up here today are not points that are specific to just Portland. They absolutely apply to Portland, but this impacts our whole state, not only from an economic standpoint, but from a safety standpoint, as Senator Johnson brought out.
Senator Girard?
Yeah, can we go back to the axle ratios that
yes,
you were talking about?
Yes,
are you proposing that it would be safe to increase those numbers?
Yes, sir.
And is it fair, would you be willing to pay a higher weight mile to do that if we made such an adjustment?
We do, and I'll address both of those. Yes, I do believe it's safe, and I give you that feedback based on a couple of things. Today, it's not only being done in many European countries, but it's being done in ports within the U.S. Heavy haul corridors, and in fact, competing port of Tacoma, has a heavy haul permit program that generates some additional revenue for them, but at the same point allows up to 96,000 pounds to be moved on the same 5-axle chassis on interstate highway in those areas around the port to better move that product through there. Yes, I do believe it's safe, and yes, I do believe that it can be done. Super chassis. So if you do not have, if you're limited to the 80,000 pounds, and if I want to put 95,000 pounds to move this cargo, it requires a super chassis to be used. And a super chassis just means that you have extra axles. If you want to add more weight today, you add more axles. And we pay extra mileage tax, fuel mileage tax, for those extra axles. The challenge is that extra equipment, that specialized equipment, is very expensive and it's very limited. Again, adds considerable cost. There are methods and means to be able to move more product quicker and move the process along smoother, more efficiently, and save costs to not only the businesses involved, but the end consumers, us. In close, I'd like to say the point is trucks are a critical piece of this logistics puzzle. Planes, trains, and vessels don't back up to our homes, businesses, and deliver the wants and needs. If you bought it, a truck brought it. Trucks and drivers deliver growth. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I guess to both of you, I'm just curious, looking at the, most everything is going through the Portland metro area to get north or to get to the port. Looking at the increased traffic that's projected to be there in the next 10 years, 10, 15 years, what's your thoughts about that?
My comment would be this. Today, there are variables and restrictions in the process at the port terminals that allow only certain times of operation during those terminal hours. That only allows us a certain amount of time to pull containers out of those terminals. Increase those hours in which we can do that. Allow truckers the ability to have access to those containers and move those goods in the off hours so we're not competing with the traffic of the daily business. Makes sense. Those are solutions that we've had to move 35% of our Oregon-based employees to Seattle to help manage container traffic moves from Seattle to service the Oregon business, our Oregon customers that we've maintained.
Gary mentioned that his train goes into Tacoma. It goes into the Tacoma port. You will hear more and more about something called on-dock rail. All the large ports in the country are moving to on-dock rail. The railroad goes right there into the terminal, so you don't have these lines of congestion of trucks waiting to get into the terminals. And that's in Los Angeles and Long Beach, I think they have 9 terminals that have on-dock rail right in. So that's going to be one of the solutions.
Our model is import load down, export load out. And I think what in Oregon needs is we could expand down to Eugene, to Kay Falls, where the exporters are, to reduce the traffic downtown. However, we need more import distribution centers to make that work. There's one in Lebanon. Everybody talks about Lowe's, but Lowe's is only doing 50 to 80 containers a week. Mm-hmm. There's probably 300 containers coming out of the valley. So instead of building our distribution centers north of Portland, I think we or Oregon business needs to promote them to go south of Portland into rural Oregon. And with that, there are jobs there. 80% of what comes in an import box goes out of Oregon. So why are we building everything north of Portland that has to go through downtown versus being in rural Oregon where we could kind of drive our own model to try to spread the wealth? If we could get half of the truck traffic in Oregon highways is empty moves. If you could move that import down, you prevent the farmers from having to drive up to get the empty to bring it down to bring the load back. So the whole idea is how do we get more importers into Oregon where the exporters are in order to drive that load model.
Senator? Yeah, Senator Johnson asked a question about the driver shortage and what you didn't really get into other than what I see you wrote up there. What do you think the state could do to help that? Are there enough classes offered?
Senator, we are going to have next Dan Smith, who is with Tioga, who was hired by Business Oregon to vet some of these solutions. And one of them is this existing program that exists in Oregon now. Currently, it's not being used because it's out of funding, but there is a driver training program. And I think he would probably be the best to talk about that because he's researched that specific program.
Great.
Senator Johnson?
We could also, I think, explore the Nebraska model.
Yes.
And see if we could import that idea to Oregon. It will take some money on the part of the state. One other thing that we shouldn't lose track of is that with all of this increased congestion and the idling and the concomitant effect on the environment, that we ought to be investing in research and development for the next breed of trucks that are the higher mileage, less drag, more aerodynamically equipped trucks. I just don't want to lose the R&D possibility here.
That's true, and the one piece I would add to the driver shortage that I think is important to reiterate is that you folks can impact is the ability to adjust the mandatory requirement of being 21 to obtain a CDL in the state of Oregon. You folks have the ability to change that. Why shouldn't that be 18, 19, or 20? That is a great opportunity for returning veterans. That is a great opportunity for responsible young adults. They still have to go through all the same requirements as a 21-year-old. That opens up the pool dramatically for us.
Have other states done that?
There are several states, I believe, that are considering that today.
I guess the question, I assume, we've never talked about that, but I assume the assumption is a maturity level?
That is an assumption, correct.
For agricultural uses, in quite a few states, there are exemptions on the weight, there are exemptions on the hours of service. That's very limited agriculture or during harvest time, and there are exemptions for age. Now, somebody pointed out, we are trusting 18, 19, and 20-year-old boys and girls at that age, to drive multi-million dollar pieces of equipment through places where they are getting shot at with heavy artillery in Baghdad and yet they come back here and they're not allowed to carry a load of hay from Tangent to Lebanon?
Yeah.
I mean, that is ridiculous.
Thank you. That's a good point.
And what part of... or what percentage of the trucking problem is the fact of people who are licensed or not retiring, but they're just not driving, they're quitting?
It's a good question. I don't have a clear answer for you, Senator Beyer, but I would say that it's safe to say the younger generation going up is not more mechanical in nature or operational in nature. We need to do things to revive that interest, show them new equipment that is more electronic today than it ever has been, and take advantage of them.
The one point that we've heard before, though, is a lot of people are quitting because of the hours and other things, is too much time away from home. Can't make money.
Well, you can make money now because we have no choice.
Okay.
My boss likes the joke that a truck doesn't have a joystick in it, so... a lot of them they're techies, right? So they want their iPad, they want their Game Boy, so they don't have that joystick in the truck like they do at home. But that's
there's another component for your drivers and anybody else that's going into a marine terminal. The abuse they get from the longshoremen once in the terminal, some people don't want to talk about, but it is terrible. Physical, sometimes, almost always in every load, there is abuse of these people. And a lot of the drivers are new immigrants to this country, and they're abused on that basis as well. So it is not a pleasant job. We're fortunate that the president of the ILW local in Tacoma is an unusual guy, and he realizes that that is not healthy for the culture. And keeping that port viable, and he's trying to do something. But I would say overall, that is a terrible challenge. So there's a lot of reasons to try to figure out how you can move more cargo with fewer truck trips and put it on rail so it rails right in. And I don't think Randy's concerned that he's going to lose too much business because he's got more than any trucker can handle right now if some of that, more of it, goes on the rail. Did any of you have questions for Shelley or Patty?
I haven't seen any. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you. It's been very helpful.
So Dan Smith of the Tioga Group is coming up, and he's been hired to vet some of these bright ideas that we've come up with at these workshops around the state.
Good afternoon. As Peter said, my name is Dan Smith. I'm with the Tioga Group. Our assignment in this process was to help bring together the information on all the different impacts, costs, and so forth being experienced by Oregon shippers, particularly the small and medium-sized shippers, and then, again, to compile the ideas and proposals on solutions, both short-term coping and long-term improvements that could be made. And we went through a two-stage evaluation process. We did a high-level feasibility check on everything, and then we've developed additional business cases. You've already heard You've already heard, you know, from the shippers and importers themselves, so I'll try not to repeat so much of what they said, but I'll try to summarize instead. We did about 40 interviews with importers, exporters, carriers, and other stakeholders in Oregon, and a few basic themes emerged. First, and a critical point, everybody we talked to would like to be able to ship through Portland as they did before. They've established their business patterns, their locations, their business models around Portland service. And so far, no one we've talked to has made any changes that would prevent them from coming back once service is restored. Second, as you'd expect, most of the firms are using either truck or rail in some combination to reach Seattle and Tacoma.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
How long is the durability of that statement that you just made? They haven't done anything to alter their practices that couldn't be reversed. How long until the international market can't put up with it anymore? When I was over in Ontario, I heard onion growers talking about Holland building some potato facilities. When do external buying patterns put the lie to this? I shouldn't use that expression. Discount the statement that you made.
It varies by trade. Some move very quickly. We've already heard from some Oregon exporters that their negotiations this year are much tougher because their customers in Asia are using last year's unreliability as a negotiating lever.
Okay.
We know that a few exporters have stopped exporting. I think Peter mentioned that in the onion business, a lot of onions that used to be exported have now been put into the domestic market. So you get first small shifts, and as the time stretches out, they get larger. It does take a while for people to change facilities and shipping patterns, but in other markets, we've seen it where the coverage of a distribution center will change. Right now, you may use a distribution center in the Portland area to supply four or five western states. If that becomes less economic, they'll start supplying those states from California instead. And you'll see the business here shrink over the years. So everybody is subject to exactly what you said, that deteriorating competitive position, and it varies by trade. The one thing I was about to say is, in fact, most of them are still using their Oregon facilities. A very few have diverted traffic up to a distribution center in the Kent Valley or someplace like that. But most of them are, let's call it, coping in place right now. Now, they've also experienced increased cost. You've heard about the much higher costs of trucking and the additional costs of rail. They are receiving usually lower shipping rates when they get to Seattle and Tacoma because of the equalization policies. But that leaves them an average of at least $100 out of pocket for each container that's moving. And that varies from some shippers are hardly affected at all. Others are you know, getting additional costs of $1,000 per container. Now, that also has a burning fuse on it because beginning next year, new ocean carrier rates will be negotiated. And that puts pretty much everything up in the air. The equalization processes and policies that have supported Portland shipping can go away if those ocean carriers decide that they no longer need to compete with a Portland vessel call. So there's a real, we are getting closer to a cliff. We don't know how deep that cliff is, but it's getting closer. We definitely know that the small and medium-sized shippers are the most vulnerable. They have the least negotiating leverage with the ocean carriers. If there's going to be a shortfall in capacity, they're going to feel it first because every carrier, every service provider out there is going to serve his larger customers first. The other thing is, if I'm an Oregon exporter and I have a price-sensitive commodity like hay or scrap metal or wood pulp, I'm really vulnerable because in some cases I'm competing on margins of around a nickel a ton. All of a sudden, I'm in a hole if moving that container to the port takes out my profit margin. I can no longer compete in that international market. One more click there. There we go. We've tried to summarize the implications around the four basic shipper needs, and the first one is capacity. You've already heard that people were having trouble finding capacity, getting the trucks that they need, finding the ocean carrier capacity, getting things moving. One thing we observed in the massive port congestion between November of last year and March of this year is that what we heard first from the customers was not that it was costing me more, but rather that I can't move my goods. Because if you can't move your goods, it really doesn't matter how much it costs. We had shippers lose all kinds of sales opportunities. And the worst example I heard was during the Ebola epidemic, containers full of decontamination suits were still on the water. Right now, ocean carriers are offering the same basic services out of Seattle and Tacoma that they were offering from Portland. In many cases, it's the same vessels and the same operating strings. So the capacity on the ocean side really hasn't changed very much. But the capacity on the land side, as you've already heard, has really taken a severe hit. Stretching those driver times up to Seattle and Tacoma means that a driver that might be able to make three trips back and forth from Portland can only make one. So now to move the same business, you need three drivers and three trucks instead of just one. We also lost barge service. A large volume of goods came down the Columbia River on barge and connected to ocean carrier service in Portland. The barge capacity is still there. The barges still operate, but there are no containers on them because there's no ship for them to connect to. Those carriers face even higher costs because it can cost up to $1,000 or more to truck from those upriver Columbia River points out to Seattle and Tacoma. Service and reliability up here are linked very closely together. Randy was talking a bit about the various deadlines. Every vessel that operates has an earliest receiving day and a cutoff day, and you have to get your container into the terminal between the two. Every import container has a first availability day and a last free day when you have to get it back. So you have to make those deadlines as well. So there are, in fact, some very tight operating constraints that all these people are dealing with. And when we stretch out those driver times, when the driver can't always make it back, when you can't find a truck and a driver when you need one, making those things becomes a little bit more of a crapshoot than it should ever be. And that affects both the service and the reliability side. The cost side, as I mentioned, varies by shipper. We've got a range of anywhere, depending upon our estimates, anywhere from around $2 to over $11 million in annual cost to shippers. And the next one. Here we've tried to summarize some of the solutions, and some of the ones have already been touched on by the other speakers here. And we've tried to match them up with both the kinds of problems they address and the time frames we can implement them in. The green sections here are ones where we are developing more detailed business cases, because either those are things that have a great deal of promise or those are the more complex sort of proposals. And I'll talk about them first. Actually, I'm going to jump to truck driver training first, because we just had a discussion of that. Oregon has a truck driver training tuition loan program. It was funded with $386,000 in a revolving fund, but that fund is tapped out and was tapped out several months ago. That program can't make any more loans until either they get more money into that revolving fund or they have to wait for those existing truck drivers to pay the money back. It takes about 3 years for a truck driver to pay back a loan. So right now, that program is stalled. You have two community colleges that provide truck driver training here. You have the Promise Oregon program, which proposes to supplement the community college scholarships to make sure that everybody can afford to go there. So there are a lot of pieces out there. Their building blocks are in place for a much stronger truck driver training program here.
Which two community colleges?
It's Rogue and Umpqua. And, in fact, the truck driver training curriculum was developed at Clackamas College with the participation of the Oregon Trucking Association. And any truck driver who completes that curriculum can often drive a truck 2 years sooner because the insurance companies will waive the two-year experience criterion if they complete that curriculum. So there's a very strong opening there for a more robust program. Let me talk about a minute about truck driver information. Rand and the others have talked about the complexities that drivers face when they hit marine terminals. It's a complex environment. There are lots of rules, regulations, paperwork, and things to be done. And if you don't do it right, that's when you really spend multiple hours in there because you wind up in a line waiting to have your problem solved. The truckers come up that learning curve very quickly, and they've been at it for several months now. They're much more adept than they were, but there are still lapses and delays. And as we bring new drivers into the system, they have to learn that system from scratch. There is a better way. A number of ports around the country provide a whole stream of truck driver advisories in the forms of emails, texts, and even Twitter messages to keep drivers informed about things, changes in gate hours, congestion, construction projects, all the things the drivers and their dispatchers need to know to manage the system and make good decisions. That's a relatively easy fix and, again, something that can be done very quickly to help ease the burden on those drivers. Another one that's received some attention, and which a couple of the previous speakers mentioned, were satellite container yards of various kinds. Oregon exporters depend upon a regular supply of empty containers, and if we can move that empty container supply closer to the location, that's a more reliable supply for them in a shorter truck trip. Likewise, if we can find places to stage loaded containers, which have to be secure, of course, once they have loads in them, if we can find a way to stage those containers, then we can break up that truck trip into a local trip and a long-haul trip, and we have a much better chance of making it within the hours of service.
Senator Jones?
What's the character of the staging area look like? How many acres do you need? How proximate to the terminal? Are there specific characteristics?
There are. The key thing that makes something usable as staging for loaded containers is security. If you can imagine, a 40-foot container of single malt scotch is worth upwards of $1 million, so you have to be very, very secure. Some of the facilities in and around Portland already provide that. The port's pilot program to handle Westwood container vessels includes staging those containers at Pacific Container Repair, which is already there near the port. If you look at the distance between, say, the Willamette Valley and Seattle and Tacoma, and if you were to break it up into two manageable pieces, that break turns about to be right about Portland. So if I was going to put a place to stage it and break that long trip into two, in fact, those staging facilities should probably be in and around Portland itself. And that has the advantage of anchoring some of that cargo handling capability in the Portland area for the future. And if we can, keeping the jobs involved on this side of the river. Now, the nice thing is there's lots of people that are in related businesses, so we don't have to start from scratch. Northwest Container actually provides some of those functions. The picture you saw of Gary's facility, those big stacks of containers in there, those are mostly empties, waiting for export container customers to use them. So there are building blocks in place. The investment in the facility, other than making sure it's got a fence and a guard check, is not very high. So, in fact, it should be something doable in the relatively near future. I think Bill Wyatt is going to talk a little bit more about developments in the Columbia River rail barge service. You saw Gary Cardwell's facility in Boardman. There's work going on to connect that to Lewiston by an interim barge service. But, of course, we also want to make sure we retain the capability to reinstate the full barge service when we get a vessel to connect it with. There's other things we can do in the near term. There's some things listed here under the services. One thing is we want to make sure we keep our eye on these sort of critical elements for Oregon trade. That includes the rail connections, the truck capacity, the supply of chassis and containers, the functions of the barge, the functions that are still there at the Port of Portland. So we wanted to monitor those so we don't get blindsided. You know, so what happened to shippers when Hanjin and Hapag pulled out without warning doesn't happen again. So we want to keep on top of the whole thing. We also want to make sure that customs processing at Seattle and Tacoma doesn't become a bottleneck. You heard Patty mention that when they saw unfamiliar Oregon cargo and unfamiliar Oregon importers, things stopped. Well, we don't want that to happen in the future, whether it's staffing or training or information. We want to make sure that bottleneck is removed. The other thing is there's a lot of small and medium-sized shippers that can use the sort of services that Patty and other third-party logistics firms offer. We want to make sure they know about those resources and have a way to tap into those resources when it will benefit them. In the midterm there, you've heard the story on the Terminal 6 on labor issues. Like most ports, Terminal 6 is operated by a contractor, and there are layers to be dealt with there between the port, the contractor, and longshore labor. There's not a lot that public agencies can do to intervene in that process. That's a long-term negotiation, certainly a difficult issue to deal with, as is the financial incentives that might be offered to bring a carrier back to Portland. So while we don't see a direct public agency intervention, we do see a need to monitor and encourage that process and see the progress it's made. Again, we also want to monitor that long-term barge capability. In the long term, there's some things we can do to improve Oregon's competitive position and its ability to handle growing trade in the future. We've got challenges now. As the chairman pointed out, we will continue to have challenges. One thing we can do is to make sure we have the required transloading, cold storage, crating, consolidating capabilities in and around the Portland area. There are already a number of firms like Patty's who offer those services. We want to make sure the capacity is there. One way to deal with overweight shipments is to bring them down truckload by truckload and condense them into ocean-going containers near the port and then move them on those heavy haul roads. Oakland does that. Tacoma does that. We want to make sure we have that capability, and we want to keep it in Oregon if we can. Those are jobs. And those are the kind of operations that will help anchor cargo handling and will help attract new services to T6. And then there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of interest in additional rail intermodal facilities, specifically in the Willamette Valley. There's some real challenges in putting that together, so we're working hard to figure out what needs to be in place to make that work.
That's it.
Well, then I think we're going to have
questions. Okay, now we're going to move to. If there are.
I don't see any questions.
Okay. Well, then we move to Port of Portland, Bill Wyatt.
Okay.
I'll let you go to the center.
Oh, was it?
Okay.
Yeah, so we're doing that. These titles are.
All right. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Bill Wyatt, Executive Director of the Port of Portland, and it's a pleasure to be here. And I just want to commend you for the lineup here. I think that you're getting maybe more than you want, but certainly a full dose of container shipping and the impact it has on the Oregon economy. So I really want to make three basic points and then talk a little bit about the barge rail shuttle that was earlier mentioned, because it's a it's not the perfect solution, but it is something new that offers opportunity and hope for some of the up Columbia River shippers. And it's an example of what is really a very dynamic industry, always changing, always adapting to changing forces. First and foremost, just a brief history about Terminal 6. So Terminal 6 actually has three different tenants. In the center, our tenant is ICTSI, the Philippine-based container terminal operating company. They're the fourth largest operator of container terminals in the world. So they're big. They operate everywhere. They're very successful. At the other end, we have Hyundai coming in, automobiles. They'll do, I think, 100,000, 120,000 units coming in, and Ford's, made in Michigan, going out, about 50,000 of them, and they are processed right at the terminal. So if some Chinese buyer wants a Navigator with a sunroof, it's installed right there, courtesy, I would say, of some Connect Oregon grants, by the way. And at the other end, Honda. Honda yesterday discharged a vessel with 2,000 Hondas on it. Fits that used to be made in the United States, now being made in Japan and shipped here because of the strong dollar. And so that's a theme that I think it's important to really reflect on. Things like exchange rates really make a very big difference. The port got into the container business in 1974. So I was just, as I was saying that, I was remembering I was a member of the State House of Representatives in 1974, so that was a long time ago. This was really the dawn of the age of containerization. Containerization was a product of the Vietnam War. The military just couldn't figure out how to get enough materiel into the country and into the places it needed to be using conventional shipping. And the idea of container shipping had been around for a while, but the U.S. military really brought it up to scale. And Portland developed the container terminal at its current location largely to serve local exporters. So to wind the clock back to 1974, the United States was very much an export-oriented economy. And then as you go, you know, sort of over that length of time, things have really changed. Now the United States as a country imports about 4 loaded containers for every 1 loaded container that goes out. And that's significant because I think, as Gary mentioned earlier, imports are so important in this business because that's how you get an empty container to send it back to Shanghai or Tokyo or to wherever else it needs to go. And where do you find most of those kind of facilities, import-based facilities? You find them where people are, right? In Southern California, New York and New Jersey, Savannah, which is actually more like the port of Atlanta, you find them in big load centers. So those of us in the Pacific Northwest are always struggling against the load centers, the big population centers around the United States, in order to make enough scale to be successful in the container business. The other thing, for the 50 years, or I should say for the first 46 years of its operation, the Port of Portland actually operated the container terminal. This is always, I would say, an unpleasant reality. No one in the industry would do it for us. It is not financially remunerative to a large extent. And it was difficult for us because we are not and never have been, nor can we be, a member of the employer association, the Pacific Maritime Association, which employs all West Coast longshoremen. So to operate the terminal, we actually had to hire one of their members to stand between us and the longshoremen. And we would say, okay, you tell him to move that box over there, which they do, and then mark it up 20% and send us the bill. And we did it because it was a very important service for us to provide. But as successive longshore labor agreements were negotiated and the costs went up, we got to a point where we were essentially liquidating ourselves in order to operate the terminal, selling land in Rivergate in order to pay the cost of operating the terminal. So back in beginning in about 2007, right before the Great Recession, we hired Morgan Stanley to do a tender to see if there was anyone anywhere in the world who was qualified and who would be interested in operating this terminal. And ICTSI ended up on the winning end of that bid, and they signed a 25-year lease. They pay us $4.5 million a year. They also reimburse us for certain maintenance expenses that we incur on their behalf. And the ILWU took advantage of this opportunity to attempt to gain greater jurisdiction for the work on the terminal. This is something that has been going on up and down the West Coast a lot, but this was a unique moment in time with a change in control. And you know, I guess I could say the rest is history. You've certainly seen the result of all that because they've been very determined to be successful. They have lost every legal battle in their way. The National Labor Relations Board has filed multiple unfair labor practice complaints. They've been found guilty. They've been found in violation of Federal Judge Simon's injunction, and so on and so forth. And enforcing all of this takes a lot of time. And frankly, time is on their side. And I think all of the conversation today really reinforces that. So without getting into great detail, because I'm just not prepared to do so, I will say there are significant conversations going on behind the scenes, looking for a resolution to this, as you might imagine. And I count myself as more hopeful today than I would have been 6 or 8 months ago. So the current situation basically is we have one calling carrier today, Westwood, referenced earlier. Westwood is a carrier that was created actually by Weyerhaeuser Corporation to take logs in those days from the Pacific Northwest to largely to Japan. And as you know, as Weyerhaeuser's business model changed, the shipping company, their arm, really changed their operation. And I think now they are a separate company. They're actually owned by Sumitomo Warehouse. Their largest customer is Boeing. And so they use a type of vessel that can carry both containers and large items. And they bring back things manufactured in Japan for Boeing's manufacturing facilities in Everett. They then go down to Tacoma, pick up a few containers. They come to Portland and pick up a couple hundred, and then off to several small ports in Japan, which for our exporters is extremely valuable because Japan is a difficult country to get to with Oregon exports today directly. They are, I will say, contemplating an expansion of their business. We're going to support that in every possible way. They're a great carrier for us, but they're small. We are and continue to interact directly with the ocean carrier community. You saw, I think, Gary Cardwell's slide up there with the 17 carriers that operate in the Pacific Northwest. Part of the problem is there are too many, but we see them all. We interact with them all. And what they're really looking for is some signal from the ILWU that they will be welcome back in Portland, to be blunt about it. And I am confident that when that signal is received, we'll see more service back in Portland because it is actually a lucrative market for the right carrier. And, you know, Hanjin, until the very, very end, was extremely successful in Portland. I know this just from my own association with the industry. Now, you know, one of the points I think I want to make, we're not in the container business because we're making a lot of money at it. I think this represents a little less than 3% of our total revenues. I always like to tell people 3% of our total revenues in about 40% of my time. So we're in it because this is really an important part of our mission. You've heard from these shippers and a lot of conversation about these agricultural exports. They tend to be lower valued. The freight isn't as lucrative for the carrier. So we all, any of us who connect to the system in any way, have to do everything we possibly can to give them access to these foreign markets because there are so many other producers out there of every commodity that we export. So the competition is keen, not just from other U.S. producers, but from other foreign producers. So a significant volume of cargo that was originally destined for Terminal 6 and the in-water service that was provided there actually comes down the Columbia River. And it comes by barge from as far away as Lewiston, stops in sometimes in Pasco or in Boardman, Umatilla, and then makes its way by barge to the terminal where longshoremen remove the containers, put them in the yard, and then put them on the vessel that's going out that week. In the end, we had both Hanjin, which was a trans-Pacific service, and Hapag-Lloyd, which was a South America and Mediterranean and European service, very valuable for a certain segment of the exporters. Well, with those services lost, the barge system fell apart, right, because there was no point in bringing it to Portland. So we have worked very closely with Northwest Container and with the Port of Morrow at Boardman to reconstruct the barge service so that it would terminate from upriver at Boardman, discharge the containers, and then go by rail to Tacoma. And we're not doing this because we're making any money out of it. We're not. We're doing it because it's a very valuable and important service. It means that the shippers will pay a little less money than they would if they were having to use a truck. But most importantly, you've heard about weight here. Well, that's not really an issue on the barge, and it's not as much an issue on the rail because we've helped to subsidize the acquisition of some heavy containers. Or container cars that you heard about here from Mr. Cardwell. We're working with Business Oregon and the shipping community to look at other solutions like this, really because we think we have something to offer to the conversation. We know a lot about this business, and we're anxious to see shippers have some solutions. Likely the best solution of all is a return of service to Portland. And I have said before publicly, I'm actually optimistic about that. I think Senator Johnson raises a good point about when the shippers themselves make so many other commitments that their return to using that service is complicated. But I think it kind of comes down to this. As long as it's cheaper, and more effective for people to use in-water service in Portland, they're likely going to use it. Cost is a big driver here. And the for some of these unfortunate egg producers in particular, the cost of the truck move from the southern Willamette Valley to Tacoma can actually exceed the value of the freight. And that's not acceptable. You know, we've really got to deal with that. And so they're always going to be, I think, more favorable to in-water service in Portland. The likelihood of developing container operation anywhere else in Oregon is really remote because the capital cost is immense.
Right.
You know, these big terminals down in Southern California that handle a million a year, a million and a half a year, those are billion-dollar operations. Replicating Terminal 6, for example, the facility that we have, which when you get out there, it looks huge, but when you compare it to these other facilities, it's a postage stamp. That's a multi-hundred million dollar terminal. It's been constructed over a long period of time and investments and so forth, but they're very, very expensive. Finding carriers who'd be willing to go elsewhere is just going to be very difficult to do. So I guess my message is, a little reflection on the history, why we're in this business, how we got there, how we got to where we are today, a flag of hope in the air. I'm an optimistic guy. Got to be if you're in this business. And then I think just an example of the kind of work that we're doing with the other players in this industry to provide some alternatives for people who need them in order to get their product to foreign markets. I'd be happy to turn it over to Gary Rother to answer any questions that you may have.
Senator Monroe?
Yeah, Bill, good to see you again. Thanks for coming down. It's always struck me that, you know, I've been studying transportation for a lot of years. It's always struck me that we have so many logistical advantages in Portland. We're sitting where two major highways cross, major rail lines, and of course the Columbia River Gorge and the whole barge system, that we ought to be able to maximize those logistical advantages if it weren't for labor troubles or whatever. And it just, you know, most people don't know that a lot of the freight going to Seattle and Tacoma comes right past Portland,
right,
and heads north. Well, that's not very efficient. So it strikes me that anything you can do, anything the governor can do, anything the legislature can do to maximize using those logistical advantages that Portland has will benefit not just Portland, but the entire state, in fact, the whole Pacific Northwest.
So that's a great point, and let me just add a couple of thoughts to that. You know, to be a port, you've got to have cargo, or you've got to have access to cargo. So the Columbia River is actually a very robust center for maritime commerce. Since the channel was deepened back in 2010, the private marine facilities have invested well over $1 billion in expanding their capacity to take advantage of the additional 3 feet. Our own tenants, $250 million to do that. The cargo that is strongest, the type of cargo that is strongest in the Columbia River is cargo that likes to take advantage of that at-grade rail crossing. So what is it? It's grain, and it's I'm not talking about the wheat that's produced in Oregon, but soybeans, which is, by the way, America's largest export to China by value and volume. Potash, soda ash, and then autos, which historically came in and go by rail back to the Midwest, but now we're beginning to see exports, and I think we'll see more of those for a variety of reasons. And containers, you know, the biggest problem for containers in Oregon generally is we're a state of, I don't know, what's our population now? 3.5
4 million.
Okay, all right.
Just went to 4.
4 million. Well, I'll tell you what, there are cities in China that you've never heard of that have 8 million people in them. And it's a challenge because we are not a load center. And so it just takes a lot of smart people working really hard to figure out the puzzle pieces to make it work. We've never had the classic intermodal aspect of container cargo, right? It's all destined for Portland and then shipped out by truck or rail or rather barge. And so that just it always makes it a little more challenging. The channel depth is 43 feet, so we can't handle the really big vessels that are now being deployed in the Trans-Pacific. But as I said, there is a business there. And if we can address these labor challenges, and I assure you, by the way, the governor is very engaged in this. She happened on her first day in office, as Vince mentioned, to get a call from the Secretary of Labor, who's trying to line up the West Coast governors to get involved in the West Coast Agreement. And so she probably knows more about container shipping than she ever wanted to know. So I hear you. And I would say, you know, just so you know this, for the Port of Portland, overall, our marine business is fantastic. The container business is really struggling, and we're spending more energy on it than I'm sure you can imagine trying to address that.
Senator Durrett?
I would just like to follow on with what Senator Monroe said. I have agriculture. I mean, it's huge in my district. Reliability is everything, you know, and it's really hard when you have testimony from people that are going to basically lose the farm because they can't ship, and somebody's tying it up in labor negotiations. You mentioned the legislature. You mentioned the governor. What can we do as a body to help? And if not, I'm a firm believer that we have to have an alternative, and that alternative is Coos Bay. But that's me.
Yeah. So, you know, I would say that the labor relationship between the ILWU and the PMA is governed by the National Labor Relations Act, so it's not easily within your jurisdiction to resolve. But I would say that, and there are definitely efforts underway to find some middle ground there. Should that occur, one of the advantages, I think, of the intensity of this experience is that everybody's a little more educated about how challenging this business is, and I think there will be opportunities, and there have been in the past, by the way, for state engagement in the container shipping industry, because the industry itself has changed dramatically, and I would say it's for the carriers, the ocean carriers, they're really on their head now. The largest carrier in the world, Maersk, just announced a 30% layoff. The ocean freight rate from Shanghai to, imagine this, a 40-foot container from Shanghai to Rotterdam, which is a long trip, is about $500, which is incredible. This used to be a multi-thousand-dollar trip because they all went out and bought these gigantic ships. And so I'm just saying there will be opportunities. I don't know if they'll present themselves in the upcoming session or not. I hope they can. And I think there are more members engaged in this subject than there have ever been, which I appreciate very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Good. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, nice to see you here as a guest and your continued ongoing attention to this. Your question, Senator Girard, really, I think, is a kind of a great leaping off point for me to make some brief comments, and I will keep them brief, Chair Beyer, out of respect for your time and schedule today, because I know that we're at or running over. But I do want to underscore the importance of this transportation initiative, and it's this is not just a T6 problem. This is not just a transportation initiative. This is about the economy. This is about jobs. And this is about, as Bill said and has said well, while none of us would wish for this situation, it does present an opportunity. It presents an opportunity for us to understand that Oregon is the 14th most trade-dependent state. Within that, and that's for all goods and services, within that, agriculture represents about 10% of the state's economy and 10% of the jobs. But that's a lot higher percentage if you get into rural areas. And it's because of agriculture that our rural economies were able to get through the recession as well as they did, albeit damaged. And I'll underscore probably for the fourth or fifth time today, Oregon is a special place. We have excellent growers here. We have excellent packers and processors in the ag industry. And we have a cachet and an opportunity to create value for our products in the international marketplace, which, by the way, I'll remind everyone that 80% of everything that we grow leaves the state, and more than half of that goes internationally. But we're not the only game in town. And while we are a food-centric state and we have a lot of high-value products, we really stand to lose that market share if we cannot maintain these transportation links. And so I think a takeaway for this is that there really is no one silver bullet. There are several options. I've been proud to serve the state for a long time in my career, and I want to thank you, the committee, for taking the time to hear about this. I believe it's important because it's not that often that you see the Department of Transportation, Business Oregon, Department of Agriculture, at the request of the governor, and by the way, Port of Portland is a partner. And I particularly want to thank the port, because although they are the Port of Portland, I'm not surprised that Mr. Wyatt says that it's 3% of their revenue and 40% of his time. They have been very diligent in trying to find ways to make sure that the state is served, and at the same time, I know that they have a business to run. So with that, I think I will wrap up and just say that please continue to support this effort as you have. I think that we can find some solutions out there, and I believe, as someone who's been in agriculture and trade for most of my career, that it does present an opportunity to really focus and remind everyone about what the economy is all about and where the jobs come from. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gary. Any questions? I think you've worn us out. A lot to think about there, and certainly one of the more important transportation problems. We usually think about asphalt and concrete, and this is a little different, but
it is
equally, if not more, important. Yeah. So, thank you very much.
Thank you all very much.
We covered it all. All right, so we're going to go to. We got a few other small issues to deal with, and we're going to start out with rebuilding in Warrenton. Senator Johnson?
I'm going to give the mayor a phone call.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hello, good afternoon, Mayor. This is Patrick Brennan, Committee Administrator for the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. You're live and on in the room. We're just about to get started on the Warrington agenda item. I turn it over to my chair, and Senator Johnson is going to be our first presenter.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us, Mayor. Senator Johnson.
Thank you very kindly, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here to introduce an issue to all of you that is extraordinarily important to the city of Warrington, and I'm so glad the mayor could join us. In June of 2013, a fire destroyed a seafood processing facility and dock that was owned by Oregon-based Pacific Seafood. This facility had been built in 1941. The fire was an accident. The facility is the largest employer in Warrington, employing 140 full-time employees that are paid above minimum wage and have health benefits, and they add an additional 100 employees during seasonal times. Clatsop County remains one of the most economically depressed counties in Oregon, and we are coming before this committee to introduce the idea that in partnership with the city of Warrington, the company, and hopefully the state of Oregon, that we may be able to provide some financial relief that would keep these jobs from going to Washington. I'm joined by Dan Acapinti, who is going to provide some technical information. He is general counsel for Pacific Seafood. There is the very real possibility that all these jobs could migrate north. Pacific has a facility in Ilwaco, and we are fighting desperately to keep this large employer in our economically depressed area. Regional Solutions is involved. As I said, the company's involved. The city's involved. This has risen to the level of the speaker who came out and toured the facility. We have the mayor on the telephone, and I would ask on behalf of the city of Warrington that the mayor make some comments and tell you how desperately important this is for his community. Thank you.
Okay. Welcome, Mayor. Would you like to make some comments?
Absolutely. And I apologize for not being able to be there in person. I appreciate this opportunity, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I don't always like to follow Senator Johnson because she's a tough act to follow always, but I think she summarized it pretty well. You know, this has been 2.5 years where we've had a real vacuum, a hole in our community, and it's something that has hit our local businesses, whether they're restaurants or stores that used to, rely on a lot of the patronage of employees from this company, from Pacific Seafoods. You know, we've had a really great relationship with Pacific Seafoods for 3 decades. They've been a member of our community, one of our largest employers in our community. And just as an example of how much it impacted the city budget, we lost about $250,000 in water revenues alone simply because Pacific Seafoods wasn't a consumer of water anymore. And that adjustment had to be made when we raised water rates to the rest of our citizens. It's been something that has really taken the whole city administration, staff, commission by storm in trying to see what we can do to try to offset the loss to our community. 10 years ago, I think DEQ had an order to get the discharge from Pacific Seafoods off of the Skipton River. We worked cooperatively to get that rerouted through our wastewater treatment plant, and it was a successful project. And I think that there are opportunities to really enhance what we're doing both in our wastewater treatment plant, but also what we're doing throughout the community. And we want Pacific Seafoods back here. It's just a big hole that's been left, and we're willing to do whatever it takes in order to get them back and rebuilt on the Skipton River.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This is Betsy Johnson again. For the record, I might just add that Pacific paid almost $100,000 in property taxes, and also for the fish landings, pays $220,000 in state fish taxes to the state of Oregon. We have been joined by Mr. Brown, the plant manager, and I just would make one other personal comment. Not only is the mayor speaking on behalf of his community as the mayor, but he also is a fish processor, and I think it's wonderful that he's advocating that a friendly competitor would stay in the community.
Great. So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Acapinti. I'm the general counsel of Pacific Seafood, and I really appreciate you guys taking the time to learn about what we're hoping to move forward with in Warrenton. I was hoping maybe I could just kind of give a little bit of background and a little bit more context to what's going on. So just briefly here, Pacific Seafood is an Oregon company. It's one of those American dream type companies where it's like 1947, a Croatian immigrant selling fish out of the back of his car in Portland. And it's turned into one of the most successful seafood companies around. And it's just something that I think the whole state can be really proud of. About 3 years ago, our company decided that we were going to be the industry leader in sustainable fisheries, and we launched a national brand, Pacific Sustainable Seafood, the green flag, and we're taking Oregon products. The fisheries off the Oregon coast are some of the best managed in the world. We're taking Oregon products and providing those to consumers throughout our state and throughout the entire country. So it's something that we're really excited about. You know, I fell in love with the company and ended up coming on board a couple years ago. And so that's kind of who we are. Our first major processing plant was the plant in Warrenton, Oregon. And it was been in existence there since 1941. And, you know, this is one of those fishing communities where, you know, you got all these independent fishermen, you got processors, and then you got all the industries that they support, the fuel guys, the, you know, navigation guys, everything. And so our Warrenton plant was, you know, a sort of pillar in that community and the largest employer in that community for decades. We bought it in 1983, and so have been running it since then. And in should I?
No, keep going.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. I'm not used to doing this.
She scares a lot of people. Don't worry about it.
So 2 years ago, our company and the city of Warrenton suffered, you know, basically a devastating tragedy. And it was, you know, a couple local roofers doing their best to do tar repairs on the roof started a fire that ended up burning the entire facility to the ground. And, you know, there's a photograph of it up there to, you know, partially capture just the level of devastation. And, I mean, just took the thing down to nothing and, in fact, burned a number of the pillars under the dock. Mike Brown, to my right, is the general manager of the facility, and you'll hear from him in a second, but he can tell you more about what that day was like. But I will say that our company scrambled in what we call, a number of people call, the seven-day miracle, where we scrambled to set up a temporary facility in the area, and we did that. We set up a temporary facility in an abandoned airplane hangar at Tongue Point.
Aviation of the rescue again.
I can see that one coming.
And we paid all of our people. You know, these are 140 jobs, up to another 100, up to 240 seasonally. You know, and our people are well paid. Our permanent employees are 401k, health benefits. I mean, these are good jobs, and Mike can talk more about like how long a number of our people have been there. But we paid them while we were down. We got back up and running in this temporary facility in the airplane hangar, and that's where we are now. And we, you know, we had hoped that we would be able to sort of get back on our feet. We've encountered some obstacles, and you know, we're looking at an estimated cost of, you know, upwards of 25 million dollars. The bid on the dock structure, the dock structure is basically kind of the, it's obviously along the water, but it also extends, and then the facility is built kind of on top of it. But that was a $8.7 million project in and of itself, because we rebuild this thing, we have, you know, we want to do it the right way, so the infrastructure's there, it's earthquake resistant, everything else. And so the insurance company, just so you know the backstory, I'm responsible for the, you know, managing this part of it. They have taken the position now, after basically stringing me along for 2 years, needing more and more backup on whether that little nut and bolt was really in there and whether this was really in there. 2 years after they came back and said, oh, you didn't rebuild within 2 years, you no longer get replacement value. So we are facing a real challenge. And then the flip side of that is that our lease at the Tongue Point airplane hangar expires in spring 17. And to rebuild this thing, we're looking at a 15 to 22 month project, so a year and a half to 2 year project with permitting, construction, and everything else. So we're basically at that point right now where it's sort of do or die. We either have to start on this project, or we got to figure out what else we're going to do, or potentially relocate. And so, I'd humbly ask for anything you can do, and if there's any questions I could answer, but maybe I'd turn it over to Mike just to introduce himself and say maybe a little bit about what the company sort of means to him, and maybe a little bit more about our team members over there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for your time today. My name is Mike Brown. As Dan mentioned, I am the general manager at Pacific Coast Seafoods. I started working for Pacific Seafood in late 1990, so just right at 25 years ago. I've worked in the seafood industry for very close to 40 years now. Mm-hmm. So I've been around a few of the other processing companies in that area. And I've seen how businesses are conducted in that industry. Pacific Seafood turned out to be rather unique, I guess, to me, having, again, worked at some of the other processing facilities in the area. All the way back into 1990, when I started there, I was offered health benefits, which I knew nothing about. I was offered voluntary participation in a 401k profit-sharing plan, which I also knew nothing about at the time. There were benefits made available by Pacific Seafood that back then were unmatched in the seafood processing industry in the lower 48, at least to my knowledge. I think I can share that, along with my 25 years there, as Dan mentioned, we range 115 to 140 full-time employees. About 40% of those team members have worked for the company for 10 years or longer, and half of that 40% are at 20 years or better. And I think there are, a lot of very good reasons for people wanting to stay with the company for that long. I see myself, quite frankly, retiring there, without a doubt. As Dan mentioned, we made a commitment very shortly, I think in a matter of about 3 days, when we knew that we could secure we were relatively positive that we could secure a lease facility to begin operating. We made a decision to, as Dan mentioned, pay our team members so that we could keep that very core structure together and be up and running as quickly as possible. I don't know that you would find that again somewhere else in this industry. We have, even to this day, we have some very, very key team members that have here and there been offered employment by competitors in the area that could quite frankly be beneficial to them in the short term, and to this day they have all decided to remain at Pacific Seafood and hang on, waiting on this rebuild.
Not only is it important to our team members, we average roughly close to 250 different vessels landing to our facility in a year's time. Pacific Seafood, or one of Pacific Seafood's strengths, has always been to have a presence along the entire lower 48 or lower West Coast, which the Columbia River being, a very significant port of landings is very important to the company. It gives us continuity in the workplace, gives us continuity on the market, which is very important. Those vessels that land their products to Pacific Seafood, they land because that's their choice of where they want to land. A lot of those fishermen are what you would call maybe working transient type fisheries, like trolling salmon and trolling albacore tuna, where they migrate up and down the coast depending on where the resource is available. And their choice, they obviously have a choice of where they can land their catch. We have a number of very, very loyal fishermen that decide that they would like to have the ability to land to Pacific Seafood. And so again, Warrington and the Columbia River is a very important port to us and to our fishing vessels. So I think that just about covers what I had to offer.
We'd be happy to answer any questions.
To me, this is a capital construction problem, and I probably should be in a different committee. But I do have a couple questions. One is, the dock is actually owned by, it's privately owned, is it not? You would own the dock?
That's correct. But the two points I'd make about that is, one, the dock and the facility is located directly across from the public ports where all the local independent fishermen are. Mm-hmm. So it's used by 250, but it is a
I'm trying to help here.
Sure.
It might not seem like it, but I really truly am here. What I would like to see from you is a specific ask and what you're willing to bring to the table. And I think that's a reasonable thing to ask for. What's your time? If we're going to put public money in it, then we want a commitment that you're going to be there for, perpetuity. And just for your information, you got probably one of the best senators for getting every dime that you can. So I don't want to do battle with her. So it's taken its toll a time or two. So anyway, I really think you need to have more of a business plan and say, okay, if you guys put in $6 million to help us with the dock, we're going to put in the facility and do whatever.
Maybe I can help with that a little bit. For the record, Betsy Johnson.
Thank you. That's an ask.
This was in capital construction and had been on the list until the day before the list was rolled out. And so we are coming back now with a plan that decreased the ask from the cap construction list by $1 million. We will have, this is the first introduction, and we use these days as days of opportunity. But by the time this comes back into the February session, we'll have the absolute operational plan. Mr. Acapinti is still fighting with the insurance company. Our regional solutions group repurposed $650,000 in a public meeting with our advisory board. The governor has committed $350,000 from the governor's strategic reserve. So the original ask on the capital construction list had been $4 million. We're now down to $3 million. We'll continue to see what other sources of money there might be, but these days were targets of opportunity to reintroduce this project to the legislature.
Okay. I think that's good.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to reiterate what I've been thinking, or what other people have been thinking, I know, is that this is a really important piece of information, and it's really important company for that community, and I think we really, all of us, want to help. Again, I was going to say the same thing that Senator Girard said, which is, what is it that you want? And so I've heard now, and I think that's...
that Senator Riley, by the chair, the ask right now is $3 million against the 25 of capital infusion that the company will provide. We're trying to structure this in such a way that Warrenton, and the mayor can attest to this, will ostensibly become the fiscal agent, and so that the city of Warrenton will monitor the rebuilding and dispense public funds under predictable progress reports. Mm-hmm. But the city will have the company will have the lion's share of the money. This is the but-for piece. Mm-hmm. In no small measure, that will accommodate for some of the new rules. The 1940s vintage plant was running under a certain set of discharge rules. Right. DEQ is going to require different rules. And so pipe that might have been this big and sufficient is now going to have to be this big and sufficient. And so these are additional costs incurred by the company, and the ask from the state is, help us out with that piece in the totality of the project. I can't say that specifically the three is to make the pipe the right size, but the company is saying we'll have added burden on us by virtue of rebuilding an old plant in a new spot. And so there's an ask for some state participation, and it's not unprecedented. I mean, in the last hearing, we heard about public money being invested in Mr. Cardwell's facility. We've heard about private money in some of the railroad improvements that have made it more efficacious to move freight. We all know about grants from OBDD to private business, and we know about strategic reserve in that same context. So there is precedent for this. The state ask is de minimis compared to the company's participation, mm-hmm. and we will diligently continue to cobble together sources of money to come in, hopefully with even a more reduced ask in February.
Thank you.
Senator, I'm very supportive of this request, but it's the first time I've heard you say $3 million was de minimis. So that's
No, the point of the story is de minimis compared to the corporate contribution. Yeah. $3 million is a lot of money.
And Mr. Chair and Senators, I guess I would just also add to that that with the nearly fivefold private investment that we'd be making as well, this is to build a 21st century state-of-the-art plant here in Warrenton where we're going to be for a long, long time.
Yeah. In no way was I trying to belittle in any way the private investment. Just poking at it.
Yeah, sure. No.
How much?
I've lost track here.
I realize the fire is devastating and I'm sure it took months. You guys reacted, got your temporary thing up. Where are you at in the process as far as all the planning, the zoning, all the regulations, and the new stuff you have to face? Are you close to building if you get the dollars to build? How close are you?
Let me take a shot at that. Just like the chair serves, I am the convener of the Northwest Regional Solutions team, and we have alerted the team. They are working through the regulatory matrix of all the permits we're going to have to get. There will be in-water work that will include getting the Corps involved, but our staff person, Mark Ellsworth, is beginning the process. We don't have anything in hand, but I think the mayor would attest to a very cooperative city and a very cooperative county to try to put these back. But we do not, to the best of my knowledge, have any permits in hand, but we have a pathway to start working on them, including the Coastal Caucus meeting tomorrow morning to hear from Mr. Peterson about what the pathway for DEQ is going to be through, not just re-permitting Pacific, but also what plans they have for other seafood processors along the coast to make sure, as DEQ is insinuating itself into wastewater discharge, not for just this plant but others, that we don't accidentally irreparably damage the seafood industry in Oregon.
Okay, just to follow up. So you mentioned earlier you have a lease on aviation building, and you said you have a time. Do you have a limited time you have that lease?
We do have a limited time. Spring 2017.
So can you get this done by?
We could. So there's an in-work water window, which is November to February, and that's when you can do the dock piling work, which is the first phase of the project. Okay. And so, we're sort of at that point where it's sort of like go, no go, and we have to figure out if we got the collage of, funds available to make a go decision. Then what we would do is we would We would work closely with all the interested parties, you know, starting this February or March on permitting, and then have those ready in place by November when we would start the in-work water window.
And when's your lease run out?
Spring of 17.
It's tight.
It would be very, very tight, which is why we're sort of up against the wall now.
Yeah, you are. Senator Monroe?
Yeah, of the $25 million of the company's contribution, how much of that do you expect to get from the insurance companies?
That's a tough question for me to answer right now because I'm in a big dispute with the insurance companies. Yeah. What I could say is the insurance companies have taken the position that there is no excess insurance available. That's their position. I disagree with that position, which is over $10 million. They've taken that position.
Senator Monroe.
So if they get their way, you have to come up with the other 15.
That's right, Senator. Yeah.
Senator Monroe, despite his boyish good looks, this is one tough lawyer. And I'll put my money on him.
Well, I wish you well. Battling with insurance companies is never fun, and hopefully you'll be successful.
Thank you, Senator.
Anyone else?
Thank you very much, for your courtesy.
Appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Mr. Chair, thank you for letting me join you for the proceeding.
Gentlemen, thanks for the drive over. Hopefully we'll help you out.
Bye, Mr. Mayor.
Mayor, thank you for joining us today.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, we've got a couple other items. We're up to here. So, all right, we're gonna do an update on the federal Real ID program. Oh, you're going to do it.
Great. This is going to be problem.
Mm-hmm.
The Real ID. It's going to be a problem.
Why is
that?
Welcome,
Tom.
Thank you. Well, you've got Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm DMV Administrator with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I have an informational item for you on the Federal Real ID Act, a little bit of background. Many of you have that background, but I'll just refresh it for you. An update on the compliance schedule that the Department of Homeland Security has put in place. And a report on Oregon status and the outlook really for that are the things I want to cover with you. As means of an introduction, some key points I want you to come away with this. The Real ID Act was signed into law in 2005. President Bush, I believe, was the one that signed it into law. So it's been around for 10 years, and there's been a series of deadlines that have been pushed out, but there have been enforcement methods put in place over the last few years, and they seem to be serious this time with the enforcement. And the most recent one that was put in place last month for federal facilities that certain cards would not be accepted for access to those facilities. The final step that they've identified in their enforcement is at airports boarding commercial planes, and that would be with the Transportation Safety Administration, with TSA agents not accepting that state's card solely by itself. There may be other types of identification the person may be required, but once the state is deemed non-compliant, that's the situation the person would find themselves in from one of those states.
So, Tom, have they done this with anybody?
Chair Beyer, there are two states right now. There's one state and one territory that have been deemed non-compliant and have not received any extension, which I'm going to talk about here in a moment. And that's it. I think it's Minnesota and American Samoa are the two that have been
identified. So what does that mean for people in Minnesota?
It means they have to provide some other form of identification.
Are they actually TSA requiring that?
I've been told they are. I don't know that for sure.
I'd like you to verify that.
I can find that out. Yeah. I can find that out for you. Oregon is not fully compliant, along with several others, states around the country. But we have received three deferrals in that enforcement process. We've provided progress reports showing where we're at and the things that are being done in Oregon, and have been granted extensions that essentially waive that enforcement action that's taking place. And we received our most recent one-year deferral of enforcement last month. So we have a
a pass, basically, until October 10th of 2016 for the cards that are currently in circulation. If the policy decision would be made by this legislature to try to comply, there would be statutory change, there's funding, there's time that would be required on our part to try to make the necessary changes. And I'll try to touch on those pretty quickly with you. So as background, this is a federal law with lots of regulations. There's a total of 42 regulations that a state must comply with. It has to do with security provisions. It talks about the cards, the issuance processes that states go through, the documents that they keep. It's a lot of different things, not just is the card secure or not. A lot of different features and factors. The penalty is just that the federal agencies may not accept that state's card for access to facilities. There is no financial penalty that's in place. You don't lose 10% of your highway fund money if you don't comply. You know, those types of things are not part of the federal law.
It boggles my mind. Part of it is you couldn't go into a federal building without an ID, which is really interesting in terms of how they would enforce that on criminals that they wanted to prosecute.
I guess they throw them in jail.
Some of the other
put them in a federal jail.
Exactly. Some of the other forms of identification that are accepted. So you might present an Oregon driver's license if it's not compliant. They might say, okay, do you have a U.S. passport, a passport card? Do you have a U.S. military ID, a permanent resident card, a transportation worker identification credential, a TWIC? There's different cards that they would accept. It appears with that non-compliant card if you presented something else.
Will my Senate ID work?
I don't think so, but you can try.
Try your library card.
So, again, they have a phased enforcement schedule. They announced that in 2013. They've done it in different phases, different federal agencies, federal buildings, and different security levels, military installations. And so they just gradually have upped the ante, basically, on what states would be, what cards would not be accepted. They have said that TSA security checkpoints at airports, not before 2016, we're almost there right now, and not before at least 120 days of notice. So a four-month notice is what we can expect. About the time it might take you to get a U.S. passport, I guess, once we get the word. So that's what they have committed to. Just a little bit of background. 2008 was the first time, I guess, we really made some efforts to try to comply with passage of legal presence requirements, cards that we issue that expire when an individual's legal stay in this country expires, so they're temporary, limited-term type cards, verifying Social Security numbers, electronic verification of immigration documents. We were directed by the legislature in 2008 to make a number of changes, which we did. We brought back further proposals in 2009, a budget request and some statutory changes to further become compliant. Not only were those two denied, the bill, Senate Bill 536, passed, which, besides saying no, it said, and if you know what state agency may try to do this without federal funds being adequately allocated, and some assurances that security provisions are going to be in place if any state agency tries to comply, effectively saying we're not going to comply. And that is in your materials. I believe that bill is included. It's a short, it's a two-page bill.
So what is your estimate, if we were to comply, what's the cost?
Senator Beyer, I'm going to have to give you, it depends kind of an answer.
That's
because
fine.
If you go across the board for every card that we issue and the changes we'd have to make, it's quite a bit. We haven't updated our estimate. It's in the millions of dollars. If you were to take an approach where you just want to offer it to those individuals who want a compliant card for getting on airplanes, then we'd have to figure out how we would do that, which offices, you know, how frequently you would, how often it would be available. Maybe a model similar to what Washington has. They have an enhanced driver license or an enhanced ID card that they offer.
I thought I just read in the paper or heard on the news that they had notified Washington that they were not deeming them compliant.
Senator Barr, that is correct. That's their standard card. Their standard card is not compliant. They don't have a legal presence requirement that they check on their standard card. But if an individual wants one of these enhanced cards, which they actually put in place for the Winter Olympics a few years ago to get across the Canadian border. It has a chip bit built into it. The people apply have to provide certain documents. The procedure is a little different that they follow. And the Department of Homeland Security has deemed that card and that process compliant with the Real ID.
How much does that cost?
It's a little more. I'm not sure exactly the price. But they have a $10 or $12, $20 more that they charge.
So for less than that, I can get a passport.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, one of the things that hasn't been mentioned is part of the reason that we, in 2009, decided to say no and hell no, is the requirement of keeping on file for 10 years all the information. And I think that, you know, that was a big factor, keeping Social Security number, all kinds of identification on file as required by the Homeland Security.
And providing access
and
to
yes,
the feds.
Yeah. And so the security of that information is a big issue, was a big issue in 2009, and in my mind still is a big issue.
Chair Byer, Senator Riley, you're absolutely correct. And the biggest provision we do not meet today is that keeping a copy of what's called a source document, identity documents, legal presence type documents, there is a requirement that the DMV keep a copy of that. Most are doing digital imaging, but they do that.
For 10 years.
I think it is 10 years.
It is, yes.
And so, and we really don't have a business requirement to keep that type of information. We see it, we review it, we check it for as valid, and we turn it back to the individual to keep. We don't make any kind of a copy or image of that. That is the biggest provision that's still left to be done and the most costly for us to do if we were directed to try to comply. Again, if you did that only for certain individuals and in certain offices and in certain areas, you know, it would be probably less expensive than if you had it for every single card you issued. And every, you know, we have 60 offices around the state to set those offices up to be able to issue under those parameters.
So the advantage of setting a system up like that is that you'd make it pay for itself and just say, you want this, this is your federal government at work.
Yeah. And require them to say it's okay for you to keep my information.
Right.
To me, it isn't the cost as much as the requirement to keep information for 10 years.
Well, it's really expensive to get to the state to a position to be able to do that.
Right.
For federal requirements that they ought to be paying for if they want it.
So, anyway.
It's much simpler just to require a federal ID card.
I was going to keep quiet. But
go ahead.
I agree with the security of the information, and I agree with Senator Riley's concerns. But in this country, we've been blessed that we have not had a whole lot of terrorist activity. If that increases, I see no other alternative but to do that. And right now, with our driver's licenses the way they are, I think that we are kind of an easy target. And so it's one of those, right now, I think, you know, you kind of lean towards let's protect the information. But if the terrorist activity starts getting more and more and we start having activities like we have in Paris, by God, I'm going to go the other way. I just am.
Well, if you're going to do that, Senator, it's a national issue, which I agree with you on. We could do like every other country, industrialized country, and go to a national ID card, which we already have. It's called a Social Security card.
But that's what they want to do with driver's licenses.
What a driver's license is. We're arguing on things we don't want to, Tom. Just go ahead and finish up. There's a little emotion on this issue.
I didn't hear a question.
I'm sorry.
Oregonian ran an article about this last year, and I approached DMV about this. And I talked to the co-chairs, and it just wasn't in the budget or the process. But it's not necessarily the money, too, but what is the time it would take you to, if they do... the feds do shut our cards down and not let us use them in the airports. What's the time it will take your agency to get up to speed if we decide to do that?
Chair Byer, Senator Thompson, Just like the answer you said, it's not necessarily the money. You know, there are other things we would be giving up in order to focus on that. We have aspirations to replace very old computer systems, mm-hmm. and this legislature has approved funding to start doing that. I think that would put that at risk. Those types of investments in our computer systems, we'd have to set aside, I think, for a project of that magnitude to take that on and start collecting the images and the training of our staff. And so it's more of a trade-off, I think. I don't know exactly how long that would take. We would try to do it as quickly as we could, I'm sure, but probably years, a couple years. Our IT projects typically take at least that much time. The other date I wanted to get across to you is besides we have the extension now until October of next year. As of October 1st of 2020, so in just less than 5 years, they have said that Homeland Security federal agencies will require a compliant card, not just a card from a compliant state, but it must be a card that's been issued under the higher, presumably higher, standards. And most of those states with a compliant card will have some kind of indicator, a different color, maybe a gold star, you know, something on the card to indicate it's a compliant card. So they've indicated that as of October 1st of 2020, those federal agencies would require some kind of a compliant card, even if your state. So when you're carrying right now that doesn't expire for, you know, 6 years or 7 years, you may have an incentive, if the state is issuing compliant cards, to go back in to get one of those.
Or get a passport.
Or get a passport.
Or get a passport. If you haven't got one. Go ahead, follow up.
The only thing, when I read that article in the Oregonian, my thought was, this is something that people aren't even aware, or our constituents aren't even aware of this, other than what they've read.
Well, they
aren't.
They go and get their driver's license,
right? And so, when they find out that they're not going to be able to get on an airplane without taking their passport, who are they going to blame? They're going to blame us because we haven't done anything. I don't know. You know, we all say, "Well, I have a passport." You have a passport. You have a passport. How many of those other people don't have a passport? And there's a lot of little old ladies and little old men out there that want to go see their kids at Christmas time.
It's a domestic flight.
And they can't get on an airplane. Hmm? We're gonna be blamed. We're gonna be blamed for that.
Flights.
So there's some of that too.
Great. A few of the other things, like I said, there aren't many things, but the biggest one is the imaging of the source documents. There's also a requirement about checking and verifying Social Security numbers at each renewal. We've suggested to them that someone who's already proven they are a citizen, they provide a birth certificate, we've checked their Social Security number, why recheck that again?
Especially if you already have it on file.
Yeah, we've already checked it. We have a record of it being, but the regulations require us to redo that. We do it in a number of other situations, a name change, a date of birth change, even a change in the Social Security number will trigger an automatic Social Security number check by us. And that's one of the things we've suggested to them is a close enough procedure to meet their requirement. But right now, technically, it does not meet the provision. Marking the cards a certain way, there are certain standards there. So if we were to be instructed to comply, we'd have to come up with card designs and standards of issuance that would meet their requirements. There's a requirement that you do fingerprint-based criminal background checks on any employee or contractor involved in the issuance of those cards. We do criminal background checks, name-based criminal background checks, on new employees and employees that promote or transfer any change, but not existing employees and not fingerprint-based. So that would be, there was legislation passed this last session, and the Department of Administrative Services is working on some rulemaking that might help us with that particular one. That might be one that we could do more administratively with existing law today.
So you just have to go through that process with all of your existing employees.
I still have a statute that says I can't spend state money to comply. And so we'd have to maybe say it wasn't for federal ID, maybe for other purposes, or if we can get it cheap enough, it wouldn't be a cost increase. Or that one's a little dicey for me with the current state law. But there may be a way, actually, to move us even closer to compliance on that one. And more administratively. I just bring that to your attention.
Tom, I would suggest that you probably want to get the legislature to address those issues one way or another before you go there.
Yes, I agree. That's not what one you want to go by yourself on. And then the last couple of provisions are just administrative. Submit a compliance package and certify that you're compliant, and then they review it and let you know. So they are lightening their standard a little bit right now. They're not as stringent on the compliance. You're starting to see some of their reports, and even the map we put in your materials shows compliant or close to compliance. It's comparable is the word they've used, comparable. So a number of states have submitted compliance packages that aren't quite up to snuff precisely, but they're close enough, and so they're starting to give them some discretion there.
So how many states are compliant now?
23 have been identified as compliant, states and territories.
Will we know before the February session if there's some other states that become not compliant?
It's constantly changing as states submit and they get feedback. We're trying to keep our maps and stuff current. If you want a report during the session, we could arrange for that to give you an update on it.
I mean, it might help to see how everybody's reacting, and like Lee said, in Minnesota, see what the citizens are, how they're reacting, and the states reacting to that.
There are currently 31 states in the same status that we're in, that deferred status. They're not compliant, but they're not non-compliant either. That's where we are.
Okay. Anything else?
Okay.
Thank you for taking the bullet on that.
Okay.
Didn't throw that one to Amy.
Yeah.
All right, what else we got here? We got one more item, road usage, the program. Hi there.
Hello. I should say good evening, probably. I'm Maureen Buck. I'm the Business Implementation Manager for the Road Usage Charge Program, known as ORIGO. And let's see. As you may recall, in the 2013 session, Senate Bill 810 passed and authorized the department to embark on this pilot for up to 5,000 volunteers vehicles. The rate charged for those taxable miles is 1.5 cents, and people get a tax on their state fuel tax if for driving those miles. The bill required us to give people options to participate, which we have done, and we're required to have one option that was not a GPS option. So what we did is we contracted with three private firms, Sanef, Azuga, and Verizon Telematics. The Azuga and Verizon Telematics options are GPS-enabled. The other one is not a GPS-enabled device. So these three firms are the ones that set up the counts with the volunteer people who are participating. They also confirm that vehicles are eligible. But so when can you hear me? So when people want to enroll, they go to our homepage, which is myorgo.org. It looks very similar to this. They can review their options, GPS-enabled or not, payment options, all of those kinds of things, and then they get to make a decision about signing up. When they sign up, they go to the individual homepage for the account manager they select. And they put in certain information like their name, their address, their vehicle identification number, and that kind of thing. When they're approved, because the vehicle has to be under 10,000 pounds gross vehicle weight rating, when it's approved, they will get a little device that looks like this. Comes in this really pretty little box. You install this in the onboard diagnostic port of your vehicle, and it will light up. The lights change depending on what account manager you have, but it activates your account, and then you drive. And, of course, as a tax administrator, the part that I like is people have to pay. So how they pay depends on their account manager. So Azuga is a prepaid account. You set up your wallet with them, and as you drive, they reconcile the miles driven with the tax credit amount, and you can see that change in your wallet. For the Sanef account, for example, they bill quarterly when the threshold of $20 is met. So all of those things change depending on your account manager. So As of yesterday, we had 954 vehicles who had voluntarily enrolled in the program, and that's the split between the various account managers. And as you may recall, there were limits on how many vehicles in each category of efficiency could enroll, and this is a breakdown of efficiency.
Now, the MPG, that's, as I recall, that's just the EPA rating? Is that what we're using?
Actually, that's a very good question, Senator Byer and members of the committee. The rating is based on the, for enrollment purposes, is based on that, but the actual efficiency of the vehicle is measured by the device, so they get the fuel tax credit based on that.
You really can measure what the MPG is?
This device can actually measure the efficiency of your vehicle. It can measure the fuel used in most cases.
Wow.
If the device is not able to read the fuel being used, then we default to the combined EPA rating for the vehicle to determine that.
Most new vehicles already have something in them that read that. So.
Right. So it's interesting. I think most people thought that the lower efficiency categories would be the first ones that would fill up, but we have found that the higher efficiency categories are the ones that are actually filling more quickly. In fact, the number one most enrolled vehicle is the Toyota Prius, and then it's followed by the F-150 and then the Subaru Outback. So those are the top three for enrollment.
It makes no sense at all.
Yeah, it does.
We also looked at retention through the program. As I said, we went live on July 1st, activated all the systems, went live on July 1st so people could actually enroll. We've had some attrition, but our retention rate is about 95%. And when people leave the program, we send them an exit survey to get feedback on why they leave.
And what have you found from that? Probably not into it long enough to get much of a trend yet.
Senator Byer, we don't have a lot of information. The number one reason seems to be people get a new vehicle, which they then are intending to re-enroll with, or they find that they want to use that port for some other purpose. They want to go by with, like, pay-as-you-drive insurance, that kind of thing. Mm. So they want to repurpose the port. And then in October, we had a requirement that tax reports come in, and that was the next major milestone for this project. And the tax reports are in for all of the account managers. The project is also getting a lot of national attention. It recently received an award from the National Association of State CIOs. That's that picture up on the far right side. We had the Pew Charitable Trust come out and do an article on this for their State Line publication. Spent a day with some of our volunteers and with the staff. And so there's been a lot of interest in this as we go forward. As you know, Oregon was the first in the nation to have a state gas tax, and now we're the first with a functioning road usage charge program. So what's next? Well, that very much depends on the road usage charge task force, and of course, what this body decides to do with the program going forward.
So, of your sign-ons, you're not quite at 1,000 out of the five. Have you got a trend line that suggests you're going to get to five?
Senator Byer, that's an interesting question. Our external QA vendor that oversees this project has said that the systems function, so we've tested that. We continue to talk to people about the program. Generally, that does spur a few enrollments, but getting the full 5,000 is really something that is depending on, you know, the public's acceptance, candidly.
Senator John.
Yeah, we just had somebody else that was up here, and we all talked about how concerned we are about information, and you're given a lot of information. What do you do to make sure that that's secure?
Senator Gerard, members of the committee, that's a great question. We actually do not get a lot of information from the volunteers. The account managers handle most of that information, like credit card numbers and that kind of thing. And they are required to actually get rid of the trip information after account settlement, within 30 days after account settlement, or when there's been paid for. So we monitor that compliance.
I pushed the program was people wanted the information to go to a outside party, not directly to the state.
Afraid that's any more secure than
afraid of the black helicopters.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Good luck with it.
Thank you.
We got another meeting at 6 o'clock.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good for you.
Go another hour if that helps get you.
I did that last night.
You did what?
We did that last night. Went until 7:30.
The green stuff?
Ted, you know, I was thinking around 1 o'clock today. I says, have we been here a week?
Feels like it.
Yeah, sure.
It seems like it.
I know.
We're out of shape. We're not in shape for this legislative stuff.
We're adjourned. Sorry about that. Sorry about that.